grandfather made him an offer he couldn't refuse.
What was that?
Luca Brasi held a gun to his head, and my father assured him that either his brains or his signature would be on the contract. It's a true story.
Okay, hey everybody, welcome to Yours, Mine, and Theirs. My name is John, and I am honored and grateful that you have invited me into your home on this, your special day. And may this podcast we produce be a masculine podcast.
Hi everybody, I'm Roy, and John and Brooke, I have an idea. Let's us make a podcast where we talk about three movies, but let's use democracy to pick them, and also there should be a kidnapping, and guess what? We're doing it right now.
I just want to say okay to that. Hi, everyone. This is Brooke, and I'm very grateful to be here on this podcast, because if I wasn't, I'd have to go to the mattresses.
Brooke, welcome back.
So, Brooke, how much of your knowledge of The Godfather is informed by
100% of it. 100% of it.
Right. You watched You Got Mail after The Godfather. Is that what you messaged us?
Immediately afterwards, I was like, oh, that was heavy. I need to watch You've Got Mail so I can understand The Godfather.
I should have done that too. I haven't seen, I actually saw You've Got Mail like way long ago, and then later in my life I watched The Godfather, and then
really?
I watched The Godfather again. Yeah, it was like way later in life. I watched The Godfather for the first time about 10 years ago, and then just this last week. Yeah.
So would you say You've Got Mail is the Rosetta Stone of The Godfather?
I would.
Okay. All right.
I would. Although it's a little bit of a, like, spoiler Rosetta Stone if you haven't seen it before, because, like...
So when you were watching The Godfather, you're like, oh, crap, I know what's going to happen based
yeah,
on my
I was.
Knowledge.
I was like,
yeah.
Oh, thanks, Tom. You ruined that moment for me. But I did, however, tweet Tom Hanks after watching You've Got Mail. And tried to, like, because I went to his Twitter page and I was like, oh, this doesn't have very much activity. So I was like, maybe he'll respond to me if I tweet him here and call out The Godfather and You've Got Mail. And I was wrong.
It's like he's too busy to tweet her. Or, I don't know.
What's he doing now? He's not doing anything. That's weird.
He's showing up at Cox Enterprises and doing interviews for our live... what do they call that when they do live streaming events?
Oh, really?
I'm the worst nerd ever. So those pictures that I sent you guys today was him at our company event.
Wow.
Doing an interview.
So how much does that cost your company to...
I have no idea.
Bring in Tom Hanks. Oh, well.
I don't know.
He's in the new Elvis movie. Have you guys seen that new Elvis movie?
I started it.
Yeah, he talked about it on the company thing. Yeah.
I'm planning on watching that new Elvis movie. I may have like a podcasting guest opportunity, like on another podcast. So I'm probably going to watch the Elvis movie kind of as research, because they want me to watch this other Elvis movie. That's a long story.
It's,
I don't know if it's
going to. It's be. Good.
Really?
And it was really good. It's just I started it. I'm pretty sure I started it after You've Got Mail, so it was like hour six of like movie watching at that point when I fell asleep. So.
John, then when you do, please tweet Tom Hanks and invite him onto that podcast. Tell him you're going to be discussing Elvis.
Okay, yeah, I'll work on that. I'll work on I'll tweet him at like I don't know.
I'll just send him a Slack message for you through the company channel.
Yeah. So I will say because. Somehow we got Caitlin Durante, and I have no idea how that happened, but I thought, from now on, let's just every single movie, right? We'll tweet the star.
And see what happens. Invite. We should send a form tweet to everybody, like, and it could just be like the only thing that's ever, on Twitter associated with us is the form tweet to whomever is like, we have an open slot, Nicolas Cage, it's at this time. Please DM for details. Thank you.
So one of the three best movie podcasts is the Movies That Made Me, and the guy's name is Josh. I can never remember his last name.
Josh Olson is his name.
Josh Olson, right?
Yeah.
And so Halloween's coming up, and horror comedies was on the table for voting, and I don't think it is going to win. But I would have been highly tempted to have reached out to him because I probably would have wanted us to watch the movie that he thinks is the greatest movie of all time.
Is it Gremlins?
No. No, it's Abbott and Costello Meets Frankenstein. He says it's a perfect movie.
It's all right. It's all right. Okay. Well, Roy is foreshadowing our October Scaraganza. Scaraganza?
Yeah.
Next month, you know, where we watch our 3 weeks in a row of horror movies. And according to the voting, though, horror comedies is not winning. We'll probably get back to that later. So
it's going
to
be in the Halloween Losers Club if we're not careful.
Yeah, no, it's... Oh, that's interesting.
I'm not helping you, I'm sorry.
Hey, no, that's okay, because I'm jazzed about what we are, what is winning,
what
so we're good.
What might happen. What might happen. What might happen.
What might happen.
Yeah. Let's That's plans for the future.
That's
for
later.
We're all over the place. We mentioned we're talking about The Godfather. That's not all we're talking about. We're talking about The Godfather, of course, but we're also talking about two other movies that Brooke had not seen this past week until she did her research, and so she picked
Brooke Fest. Yeah. I really appreciate that.
It's a Brooke Dude Fest with The Godfather, with and
what's that movie called? Is it RRR? Is it Triple R? Is it
I'm choosing
Okay.
You know, when I was in college once, I'm gonna go with that too, because I was in college, my friend Kyle and I, and two of our other friends, mind you, actually three of them, we were all sitting watching the news, because back then you did that. And it was, I don't remember which channel it was, NBC or CBS or something. And this guy is like reading off of the teleprompter and he's like, in Cancun, there was a hurricane. Kyle and I looked at it, like he kind of cocked his head to the side and his voice went up, and Kyle and I looked at each other and were like, what the hell just happened on the TV? And no one else caught it. And like he kind of like shook his head at the end and like started reading the teleprompter again, but like I swear someone totally messed with him.
So
and put that
he did a Ron Burgundy where someone just put a bunch of R's at the end of Cancun.
So. Cancun.
Going on, we also watched The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent. That's another movie you'd never seen, Brooke, and it's where you were in a really masochist mood because you said, you know, when the first time you were on with us, we watched these kind of semi-kind of female-oriented movies, a little bit, just a little bit, and you said, hey, you know what, let's lean into the masculine this time. Were you just, why are you asking for it? As far as, I mean, because it seems like, it seems like,
I don't know what that,
it just
still
seems,
not asking for it.
It just
still
seems,
not asking
a,
for
it just seems a little brutal to just, you know, to go so deep into like masculine testosterone type movies.
I mean, maybe it's because I'm single. Maybe it's because like I need a little more masculine, or maybe I'm just feeling like a little effing salty right now.
Oh,
like,
okay.
I'm trying to like watch my language on your podcast because I like you both.
We'll have to be salty.
Oh no. What movie is that from?
Oh no.
Yeah, because like, oh no.
It sounds like Kristen Wiig a little bit, Zooey Deschanel.
No, it's a guy. No, it's a dude. He did something and he's like, oh no. I'll figure it out. Anyways, Paddington 2 is the best movie ever. I felt like if I was going to take an opportunity to be able to discuss movies that I had never watched before, they were probably going to be like I wanted to do good movies, which meant they were probably going to be super masculine movies that I just never found a reason to watch before. But if I watch movies like this, I know I want to discuss them afterwards, so it's not like I can just turn it on a Friday night and be like, oh, I'm going to watch The Godfather, because then I will spend the next 6 hours messaging the franchise podcast, like, message after message after message, because I need somewhere to talk about it. And that just annoys them, and they get really frustrated when I take up the whole chat talking about the Batman. And so I was like, fine, if I'm not going to, like, I guess I'm going to force John and Roy to talk to me about these really manly movies that I've never seen before but really want to see. So,
okay,
thank
so it's
you
a consulting
for being my outlet.
Opportunity.
I need the outlet to talk through them.
Okay. Well, you couldn't have found two manlier men than me and John.
That's so totally true.
I didn't laugh at that. I did not laugh at that.
I sent a picture to the John JB and my brother Josh messenger chat, and it's sexy as hell. So I know all about being a man.
So. Yeah, I'll probably post that on the blog. Watch for that. It's really, I don't know. It's
a real treat.
Yeah, it's a real treat, I guess.
It's sensitive, but it's masculine at the same
sensitive,
time.
Shows mysterious? A surprising amount of skin. But yeah, it's one of your better self-portraits, right? So.
I feel cheated.
All right.
I'll send it to you, Brooke.
Yeah, please get that going all over the internet. So, Brooke needs to go to the Tetons, we should probably dive on in.
Let's dive on in. Okay.
Yeah, what? Anyway, never mind.
The Godfather is the first movie we're talking about. Brooke, you assigned me The Godfather.
I did.
And actually, you know, and since you made the assignments, okay, now I'm just curious. What made you make these assignments? Did you flip a coin, a three-sided coin, to make
You're Italian, John.
I don't know. It just seemed right. I had a very definite feeling that I needed you to do this one.
It's almost as if I needed it.
It was a revelation.
I will say I was like really stressed out watching The Godfather this time, because this is either my second or third time watching The Godfather. And as I was watching it, I'm like, I am following this plot less closely and I'm more confused by what's happening than the first two times I saw it. It's just one of those weird things. It's like, I know everybody on screen knows what's going on. I know they know their place and their politics and their position in part of the five families and, you know, who they're double-crossing or whatever. But I'm starting to lose it with all these guys. Okay, but let me just try to... Let's just get this straight.
Yeah.
The Godfather goes in five, like, quadrants, even though quadrants are four things. Okay, the first quadrant, or the first scene, the first big part, the first Godfather part, the first part of The Godfather is the wedding of Connie and Carlo, Don Vito Corleone's daughter. We get the sense that Don Vito Corleone is the Godfather of the name of the movie, although that could be debated about who the Godfather actually is. And we meet his family, his son Michael, who is a war hero from World War II, so this is in 1945. And his other son, Sonny, who is named Sonny because he's a son, maybe. And he is the hothead, and he's going to take over the business someday. We meet Fredo.
Well, apparently Sonny, he has 95% of the testosterone in this movie.
Right. Like, the first son got all the testosterone, and the other sons were just kind of
Fredo, left. Fredo has negative testosterone.
He has negative testosterone. That's Fredo. And, he's just kind of this, he's just a puddle of man that erupted slowly from Don Vito.
He's like Buster Bluth, but not funny.
Yeah. And then there's enough testosterone go around for their adopted, you know, brother, Tom Hagen, who's the consigliere, lawyer of the family. So anyway, that's the family, and it's great because Connie and Carla, they just have life in their eyes, and they're looking forward to a great future together. Wonderful marriage ahead for Connie and Carlo, yeah. So, also, we get the sense that, you can ask a favor of the Godfather on his daughter's wedding day. So it's a very popular wedding because he only has one daughter, right? So everybody's lining up, raring to go. And we meet a few of the people who were asking for favors. Second phase of the Godfather, the L.A. phase. That's where their friend, Johnny Fontaine, who the Godfather has a very vested interest in. He's the literal godfather of Johnny Fontaine. Johnny Fontaine is like, they won't give me this part in Hollywood. And so Tom Hagen goes to Hollywood to talk to the Hollywood guy, and he's like, give him the part, and the Hollywood guy is like, Tom Fontaine ruined what sounds like a very lovely lady that this Hollywood producer was interested in. And he was mad at him about that. So, you know what? The old horse in the bed. That'll solve that Hollywood guy's
Thanks,
problem.
Tom.
Which was Tom Hanks ruined it for you.
Yeah.
The most shocking moment of the film. Tom Hanks.
Okay, now the interesting
but
middle.
But seeing
part.
It like that, like the sheets just covered in blood, and that's still a great scene, even if you know.
Yes, it was.
It's gross. It's gross.
His initial thought is, "I finally had my man period," but that's not the case. It's a horse head.
Oh. May as well get to a question that I was saving for questions. But how in the world did they get that horse's head in the bed without
waking him up? I don't know. I think about that every time.
He's an LA producer. He's probably doped up on so many things to get through his day, and then so many sleeping pills to go to bed.
Like, yeah, seriously, do you think they walked the horse into his bed and then like had a gun to the horse's head and like, we're gonna kill this horse unless you like let him in? And then they just like kind of shake him and slap him around trying to wake him up, and then it's like, oh man, let's just cut off
this
the horse's head
nowhere.
And leave.
This is not working.
Yeah. Okay, now the confusing part. Some of the other mobsters want Don Corleone to get into the drug business. Don Corleone is not into drugs. He's like, no, it's bad for business, you know. And you know, speaking of, if you want to get mixed up in the mafia, it seems like Don Corleone's family is like the one to get mixed up with, because they're kind of like they're almost too nice to be mobsters, I would say. They're just really nice guys for the
most part. They seem to be the gatekeepers, right? Like the other families kind of depend on them a little bit. But so this is the interesting part of the film,
yes.
Because you look at this film and there's no good guys in this film. Everybody in this film is a bad guy. I guess maybe you could say Connie isn't, because she's just pretty innocent and doesn't really have a part of any of this, right? But it's not like the Corleone family is the good family, but we can be sympathetic with them because they turn down the drug trade, so they have the moral high ground, and right, like, and so you bring in the real villain, who's the Sollozzo guy, who starts all the problems, right? And through Sollozzo, we're able to sympathize with the Corleones, and somehow we kind of get it in our heads, we're rooting for the Corleones, they're the good guys. But they're really not. Like, they do many murders. There are many, many murders.
Many murders. It's pretty much like, okay, of the five families we've seen, maybe the Corleone family is the best of the five?
The least murderous.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. They might be the most murderous.
They might be
they're
the
just
most
the least
murderous.
Druggy.
They're the most murderous because they were the most pushed around, maybe.
Yeah.
Like, it's, like, reactionary. Okay, it could be justified. And also, it is kind of funny because, like, Don Corleone is kind of like, he says drugs are messy, but he does say it in, like, a business sense. Because the big thing that the Corleone family has is political ties. That's, like, their asset to crime families, right? And, you know, so Don Corleone is like, Vito is like, hey, we can't get involved with drugs because then that would sever our political ties, and then that would make our family less powerful.
Which he totally misreads that, thinking that politicians are going to get scared because of drugs, right?
Maybe, yeah. But that's what he says. Anyway, he's like, okay, Sollozzo, we're not getting involved in the drug business. And so Sollozzo's like, okay, it's business, whatever. Anyway, so Luca Brasi gets murdered because he's who the Godfather sends to just kind of, hey, check out the Sollozzos. And he gets murdered.
You could say it's Sonny's fault that Sollozzo takes the path he does, because Sonny kind of tips his hat that he would be interested in doing the drug thing, right? And so Sollozzo gets in his head, well, we just get the Godfather out of the way, and if I can explain that it's just business to Sonny, then we're in business, right? Mm-hmm. So it's maybe sort of Sonny's fault that everything happens.
That's totally good, because it's just that one thing he says in front of Sollozzo.
Yeah, and you know, Godfather says never go against the family, never like speak against the family, right? And then we hear that exact same line later in the film from Michael to Fredo.
It's weird how soulless Michael is right from the beginning, because Michael is like, I don't want to be a part of the family, but pretty much all the big things he says are just repeated things from what his father says.
Yeah. Yep. And I mean, that's the crux of this movie, right, is Michael's journey. You're trying to sum this up, and we're already getting into this, right? Mm-hmm. But it's Michael who decides he's going to be pure, and he brings Kate into it. And Kate, of course, is played by Diane Keaton.
Sorry, Katie.
And so he doesn't want to have anything to do with the family, but then like he slips in real fast, and it just happens really quickly. And I think he learns pretty quickly that as long as he's willing to kind of do the things, the illegal things, that he can kind of have whatever he wants, right? Like he goes over to Italy and he finds a girl that he's attracted to, and he totally uses his family's connection and his and threats to marry the girl that he wants to, right? And so the power corrupts him so fast. And then that's what Godfather 2 is all about, how he spends the entire movie saying that he's going to take the family legit, but he never does. Right?
Spoilers.
Sorry, it is funny. Yeah, it's funny. I'm so confused right now because last year
we did
The Godfather Part 2. It's so strange to kind of go do them in reverse order. And I think maybe that's one of the reasons why I kind of got a little bit confused watching it this time, but that's fine.
Most people think The Godfather 2 is better. I think I like this better. I just the idea of that they're able to manipulate the audience into rooting for a bad family and bad people, mm-hmm. and so the manipulation of the audience, but also the like, you know, there's a Killers song, right, where it says you don't have to drink the devil's water, but you can dip your toe, or something like that. Uh-huh. But Michael learns that you dip your toe, and pretty soon you're doing swan dives, right?
Right.
So it's just mm-hmm. astonishing how fast he is corrupted, and then of course the incredible closing scene. Sorry, John, you're probably on quadrant four now.
We're still in quadrant three. There are some things that have to happen. Okay, but I did want to talk about this exactly. I watching it this time, I found it really interesting that Michael keeps saying to Kay, you know, he's like, I'm not like my family, you know, I want to be a different person than my family. But, like, watching it this time, I'm like, I think he's just going through his rebellious phase because, during that hospital scene where Vito's in the hospital, like, he just kind of clicks and he's just like, I am with you. He kind of says he doesn't appreciate his family just to Kay. Like, that she's the only one. And yeah. I feel like it's like a weird side effect to him being so close to his family, to him loving his father so much. It's unfortunate that they have that family bond because the family is involved in serious organized crime. And so
Lots of murders.
Yeah, so the fact that he loves his father leads him straight to, okay, you know what? Because this is for my family, whom I love and who I'm close to, I'm going to carry on this because this is more important than, you know, the outside laws of the world.
Yeah. What is it exactly that Michael does, John? Is that in quadrant three or is that four?
In quadrant three still. Vito's in the hospital because they try to kill Vito. They kidnap
him. He gets shot 10 times and survives.
He gets shot a bunch of times. He's Marlon Brando. He's put on a lot of girth. Fortunately, that girth saved him, I suppose. His jowls saved him.
By the way, this Marlon Brando, who looks so old, is 8 years younger than Apocalypse Now Marlon Brando?
47 years old, this Marlon Brando.
Yeah.
I could be this Marlon Brando. That's me.
Wow.
Yeah, almost.
That's
I'm almost our age now. Yeah,
yeah.
We're Marlon Brando in The Godfather. That's what we are.
Okay. So they definitely age him up because he's not old enough to have like 35-year-old Sonny as a kid, right?
Here's the thing.
I hope not.
35. That's true. Sonny must be like, yeah. Okay, no, that's funny. Here's the thing. Salazzo. Salazzo, he has the cops in his pocket. He has a bad, corrupt cop on his payroll named McCluskey, and McCluskey punched Michael and everything. Anyway, this is, I'll just say it, turlet gun. So, with a turlet gun, Michael guns down the main bad guy of the other crime family. He guns down the corrupt cop. He flees to Italy. You already said the part where he goes to Italy and he meets his wife there. But the tendrils of the five families reach Italy. His young wife is killed. He comes back from Italy.
John, yeah. What day is she killed on? Is it Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday?
Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Wednesday.
Okay.
She goes Thursday, Wednesday. Yeah. Yeah. also,
so can I ask?
Yeah.
Was that bomb in the car meant for him, and they didn't anticipate his wife starting the ignition?
That car bomb was meant for him. Like, why would she be starting the car?
I don't know. Well, yeah.
Women don't drive.
Don't. Women don't drive.
Not in Italy.
Thank heavens. Not, yeah.
They should have, you know.
So.
But they should have. She should have realized. They both should have realized there was a bomb in the car because the steering wheel was on the wrong side. Like, it was a. Like, I think they had to move the steering wheel over to get the bomb in. Yeah.
So, when I was 10 years old, I was driving with my uncle, and he, like, it was just me and him, and he said, "You need to understand that women are awful drivers." And I don't know why it came up, like what the context was, but he just offered it. And at that moment, I had two options. One was to like go, he must be right. He's older and smart. But the option I went with was, okay, my uncle is not a very good person when it comes to a girl women. So, but I'm assuming that it was meant for him. It doesn't make sense why they would just like punish him by taking out his wife. So,
yeah. Yeah. Unless, I mean, if they wanted to, it just wouldn't be efficient enough. I mean, it would just be too dangerous to kill his wife. That would just, you know, if they wanted to be sadistic about it, that's one thing. But, you know, there just aren't enough resources in the other mob families to just like, oh, just kind of to toy with the prey. It's like, oh, no, you just cut him off immediately, I would say. Okay, Connie and Carlo, I was kidding about their marriage. It's not so great. Here's the thing. I kind of wonder that whole scene where Connie is like throwing plates and everything to try to get Carlo mad, and you know, her calling Sonny is like, "Oh, Carlo, he's screwing around on me. He's being really mean and everything." I almost wonder if she was in on it too, because what's the weird that's the weird plan, right? Like Carlo's plan, because Carlo is in with with Salazzo or whoever else. Or Barzini. There's a weird question about that, like who's really pulling the strings, because that's one thing. I don't know if it's super important, but that's one thing I don't really understand. Like, his whole plan is get her throwing plates and then calling Sonny, so Sonny gets mad and drives his car to a toll booth where Sonny gets gunned down. Like, that's a weird plan, right? And she's kind of acting weird. I kind of wonder if they're like, okay, you both have to act strange so Sonny comes after you. And so I wonder if Carla may have actually been in on it. Or
nah.
You mean, no, I don't think she
is. They wouldn't have brought her in. They wouldn't have trusted her. They wouldn't have let her. Like, she wasn't a consideration at all.
I think that he probably, like, Carlo probably didn't need her to break plates for an excuse to beat her up. I mean, it looks like he has done it. Well, and we know he's done it before, right?
Right.
This is not the first time. And I, like, for this movie, which has some difficult scenes to watch, the scene where he's abusing Connie was just really awful.
Right.
And that
it's interesting. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
So I read a book last week called The Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo. It's a brilliant, brilliant book. But one of the lines, she's describing one of her marriages, and she said, "I reached over and I grabbed my friend's hand, and he looked at me with disgust that I wasn't holding his." And then she says, "I knew that later he was going to beat me up for that, but that he was going to find another excuse to do it."
Yeah.
Right? Like, there would be something, like, that was the thing that hurt his ego, but he would find another excuse to take it out on her. And I felt that same way watching that scene of, this is not about the plates.
Yeah.
This is about him having dominance or expressing whatever it is. Like, the fact that she called him and caught him with this woman, she's ruined his plans. She's shamed him. She's brought this darkness to the light that he didn't want to have to face. And that was why he took it out on her.
So I think he would have beat her that night regardless. I don't think he needed the plates. But I also think, like, her breaking the plates kind of shows me, like, she's supposed to be really young. By the way, Talia Shire, oh, I love Talia Shire. But I think breaking the plates is just a sign of, like, she's trying to deal with this really awful situation. And she's kind of, and I mean, he calls her spoiled, right? But she kind of has, like, had anything she's wanted for her whole life. But I kind of feel like her breaking the plates is just a reflection of immaturity at a really young age, because that's the impression I get, is that she's supposed to be maybe in her late teens. But anyway, like, I don't So, like Brooke said, she's not part of the plan. Just that Carlo knew that he could make her angry, and that would be all the excuse he needed to beat her, and that's all that what needed to happen to get Sunny on the road.
Right. It just seems like a weird plan, is what I'm saying. It's just
it is. It's a little complicated, and yeah. I'm right.
Yeah. It's just okay. Just like get Connie mad enough that she calls Sunny, and then that gets Sunny mad enough that he just drives his car without like a mafia escort. And, you know, we're going to set up a toll booth just like in Europe, you know, and, you know, Sonny's not going to fall over because he's going to be held up in bullets.
Oh, I know. Like so many bullets being pumped into his body that he can't actually he can't fall to the ground. Fall. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like the thrust from the 300 bullets
yeah.
kept him on his feet longer than it should have.
Yeah. So bye-bye, Sonny. Anyway, so, of course, the next oldest is Fredo. And so Fredo's the new godfather. Okay, just kidding. No. Michael is the new godfather. He starts taking charge. First of all, he fires Tom Hagen, and he's like, hey, let's move out to Vegas. Fredo's been setting some stuff up with Mo Green. Let's take over Mo Green. And so they kind of go over and muscle Mo Green out, and Mo Green gets really mad. But, you know, they do it. And then Connie has her baptism of her son. And so he goes to the baptism, but during the baptism, Michael orchestrates the murder of the heads of all the other families and Mo Green.
And Mo Green.
And also Abe Vigoda, who, you know, he was the messenger of the other group. Like, Abe Vigoda's on their team and everything. But, you know, they killed their own member of the team because, you know, he kind of turned traitor just by saying, hey, let's meet with these guys, you know. I don't know. I thought that was pretty stupid. And he took it like a man. He just like, okay, fine. He just walks into his executor's car. And then Michael says he interrogates Carlo and realizes that, of course, Carlo set up Sonny. And he's like, okay, don't worry. You know, we'll take care of you. Thanks for admitting it to me. And then he has Carlo killed. So anyway, it's pretty much like that sequence in – and I think I said this for Godfather, too. It's like that sequence in Breaking Bad when everybody, like, has to be killed at the same time in prison, you know, yeah. like, because they had to hush up all the witnesses. So Michael is now the Godfather, and I kind of think, you know, especially when you watch this with The Godfather Part 2, I kind of feel like the title of the movie is, like,
Michael.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, when we're looking at The Godfather, it's like Vito is completely established, and the idea of, like, the action of the movie is, like, okay, his close son, who doesn't want anything to do with the business, how does he become the godfather? Kind of like, you know, how does one break bad, speaking of Breaking Bad? But it is really interesting. Godfather 2, I must admit, I think I might like Godfather 2 better now, especially, you know, because I love Godfather 1 because it's just the straightforward story that I had a difficult time following this time. I don't like The Godfather 2 because it has that parallel storyline between Michael and you know, his father Vito. But the parallel storyline is so great because, you know, it's Vito's ascension and Michael's descension. And we talked about this when we talked about Godfather Part 2 last year. Everybody listened to that. We talked about it with Andy. It was really, really good. So that's what happened to The Godfather. That took 20 minutes longer than I wanted it to, but we talked about a lot of good stuff in the meantime. Brooke, you've got mail. Was Godfather anything like what you suspected it would be?
Yes.
Okay. Is that good?
Yeah. It's yes. Pretty much like because Joe Fox is the godfather. He's from a wealthy family, and he totally manipulated Meg Ryan into getting his way with her, and then it all worked out in the end for him.
I feel like you can't have watched movies without having an understanding of the Godfather, even outside of You've Got Mail, right? And so it's like, there really is a lot in our culture that's based off of this movie and reference to and just news stories and mafia and things in general. And so, like, it wasn't outside of what I was expecting, but it was as impactful as I wanted it to be, although I didn't know what to expect from it.
So I feel like this movie and Casablanca, when people see them for the first time, both of them, it's like, oh, that's what people are talking about. Oh, that's what people are talking about. Oh, that's where that's from, right? Like, there's just so much cultural zeitgeist from these movies. But I think this movie is made really well. And to John's point that I think it's about Michael, the opening shot just so firmly establishes the power and the respect and the intimidation, right, that Vito Corleone has. Like, he's in his black tux, he's in a dark black room. And then at the end of the movie with the two guys kissing Michael's hand and the doors closing on him, there's just no question that he's all powerful and that he has completely sunk to the depths of that he was trying to avoid. And it's just, I can't think of a movie that has a better complimentary beginning and ending scene. But the Godfather is an immense film, and it's been a while since I've seen it. So thank you, Brooke.
Yep.
Almost as good as You've Got Mail.
Almost.
I mean, not as many murders in You've Got Mail.
No. It's true. They really dropped the ball on that.
Yeah. Well, do you have any thoughts? John and I, during this masculine movie and this masculine podcast, have taken up 90% of the time in talking about this movie, but we would love to hear.
I mean, as it should be.
Okay.
I'm kidding. I found it very interesting. Like, there's so many dynamics, and I think as I spend so much of my time looking at media and how it impacts the world around us and if it still holds up and all these different things, I see very commonly this theme of, are these movies being written as smart as they seem to be? Or are they being written as per what people know, and so therefore they're getting lucky with how smart the movies are, right? Like, are they really portraying these intricate relationships and subtleties between men and women and family and different things? Or is it just being, do they just get lucky writing it that way? Like, you look at the Disney princesses and it's like, well, you know, like, Belle was being suppressed by her father, and she was being suppressed by the town, and then by Gaston, and then by the Beast. And what a beautiful way of writing that, like, to show us that we need to not be held down even by our own parents. And or did they just get lucky? Oops, sorry. Did they just get lucky that is how they wrote it because that's all that they knew for the time period? And I think most of the time they just got lucky, and they wrote what they knew, and so it brought out very intricate and interesting problems in society that we can now go back and look at and examine and find all this worth in. However, I feel like with The Godfather, they really were that smart.
Are all the Coppolas this smart to include Nicholas Coppola?
Nicholas Coppola, yes. This is a Coppola, I didn't even think about this. This whole podcast is a Coppola family reunion of sorts.
Yes, I don't know if that's a surprise to you, Brooke, that Nick Cage is a Coppola. He changed his name.
What?
Yeah, he wanted to go out on his own. He didn't want to depend on the family name, but he is he's 100% part of the Coppola family.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, look at how clever I am. See, I just got lucky.
Something can be set up for getting lucky, especially if you write what you know. Then you know the truth is examined by what you know. If you write what you don't know,
yeah.
I mean, I suppose writing what you don't know is.
Hey, John, we lost you.
There's something though about the magic about writing what we know, right? Because if we're writing what we know and what we're living and experiencing, I'm hoping John will come back. But if we're writing that, then we are writing the current issues in society. It does actually bring out the bigger things that we want media to show to us and that we want to be able to examine and do better. And so is it lucky or is it by design that if we really write well, I'm helping write a book right now where it's this like hero's transformation journey, and the first two passes that were done on it, everyone was writing from the knowledge of where who he becomes later and his transformation. And I went back through and I was like, we need to not do that. The magic of these stories is the reveal of the change, right? So even though we know that he is sad and lonely and in this space in the future, while it was happening, he thought he was on top of the world and that his addictions didn't matter and that he was in charge of everything. And so we need to write that moment as though, like, even though the audience is going to be able to look at it and be like, ooh, he's high and destroying his life, and this is not magic. We need to write it as though he believes that still, because then later as he transforms and becomes so much better, that will have the impact that we want it to, not the understanding that it was always there, right? And so yeah. I feel kind of the same about these movies. Like, we're watching them. We don't necessarily want to write for the best state of the future. We want to write for what's right now so we can show it and really examine it and evolve together, I guess. I don't know.
Oh, no, very interesting. So John missed all that. And
can you hear me?
We can now.
I think I bumped my mute button like 5 minutes.
you big dummy. Yeah. So, Brooke, let me ask you this question. This movie is mostly male characters, and I think maybe the most prominent female character might be Kay. So what do you think about the Kay character? She comes across superficially as sort of passive. She just sort of lets things happen to her, and it's in the second movie where she asserts herself more. But what do you think of Kay?
Ooh, that's an interesting question. I think that Kay is... every time I open my mouth, I just hear your dad saying that I was the psychobabble one. I think that Kay was dealing with some of her own avoidance of trauma, right? Like, we recreate patterns in our lives, whether we mean to or not. And I think that she was trying to be this big altruistic person because she had lived through some garbage in her life and was trying to be better than her family, but then ended up in a family that was just like whatever her past would have been. Otherwise, I think her altruism would have not allowed her to accept the lies that she was being given. She was willfully allowing herself to be lied to, and I believe lying to herself.
No, yeah. Like, does it comes across as she's so willfully ignorant. Not even ignorant, right? But like
choosing.
She allows herself to believe things that are very difficult to believe. And at the very end, in the final scene, when she sees like the doors closing and they're calling him? Do they call him Godfather? Or do they call him Don Corleone?
I think they call him Godfather.
They call him Godfather, and then she kind of has that look on her face, right? And so maybe like the veil comes off a little bit, but
I think in that moment she makes a decision. Like, she is sad.
Yeah.
But I believe, having been this woman, having made these decisions, right, not out of judgment of her, but out of, like, recognition.
You married
like,
the Godfather.
I believe, well, you know, out of 4, 5, 6 marriages, whatever, you're going to end up. No,
one of them is going to be a Don.
I just think that she had this sadness in her that I recognized of, I am choosing right now to lie to myself and accept this.
Yeah.
So that I can stay in the life that I have around me.
Yeah, I don't think too much of Kay. I think that's probably a big problem with I think I can't.
I wish the women had a better backstory.
Yeah, no, for sure. But the thing is, and this may be colored by some of the podcasts I listen to about The Godfather earlier, which, you know, might be a bad idea because, you know, some of that opinion colored it, but it really does seem like Michael went out of his way to find the most naive wasp he could, you know?
But he was courting her when his intention was to not join the family business.
He was.
He never had that intention.
But yeah, like I said,
let's be very clear. He always knew.
I think he did. I think he did
always
know.
He was living in a space of like, I'm going to go be the prodigal son and enjoy this moment of feeling like I'm better than the rest of my family. But in his mind, he always knew he'd be back. That's why he came so quickly.
And I think he liked Kate. Like, he married that Italian girl. I kind of think that was sort of his, more of his, love story a little bit. You know, I think there was actually more romance in that, strangely.
Oh, yeah.
Even though he didn't really know her very well. I kind of think Kay is his connection, like the waspy part of the nation. And this is the part that, you know, maybe my opinions were colored because I'm impressionable. But after... I can't remember if after Vito went to the hospital or after Vito dies, and he goes to Kay and he says, "I need you."
Yeah.
I think he's kind of got dead eyes when he says that, and it wasn't so much like, "I need you to support me as, you know, my wife and, you know, the woman who loves me and everything," but more like, "I need the appearances of kind of, a wholesome, all-American, non-Italian wife to be able to, get the political things I need in the future."
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. I feel like, and felt during the movie, that he did actually fall for his wife in Italy. Yeah. That he was having fun. But I also feel like it was this, like, it's what I call to myself and my clients, fairy tale dress-up. It's when you allow yourself to just like not care about the future, not care about anything at all, and just go fully into the excitement and exhilaration of chemical and attraction and make believe, and you go into fairy tale dress up and you're like, "This is everything I want." And here he is in Italy playing make believe until he gets to be called back home. Like, nothing there was real to him. Nothing there had long term impact. I don't think he expected his wife to be blown up, but I think there was a part of him that knew, this is the most reprieve I will ever have in my life of being able to absolutely just slough off all my responsibilities and my family. Like, I'm this individual being given carte blanche to just enjoy myself. And he found a woman and he fell in love and he loved her. And then everything came crashing back down, as family and responsibility and who he really was and all of these things, when his wife gets blown up and his dad has been shot down. And so all of a sudden he's like, "Well, I better go back to what is known and reliable." And here's Kay, who is willing to believe whatever I tell her, who's going to sit at my feet and be quiet, be submissive, be the woman who doesn't question me too much, but still gives me some sort of interaction, who will be a mother, who will do these. And I think you're absolutely right. When he went back to Kay, there was no emotion there. There was no love there. This was a means to an end that got him what he needed through a woman who would do what she was told.
Those shark eyes, those dead.
Yeah.
Irony to it because, you know, Kay is the liberated modern woman. On a different podcast I listened to, they talked about, like, in the book, Michael is kind of having constant sex with Kay, like, at the beginning, because, you know, she is sort of like the more modern woman who, like, kind of, quote, makes her own decisions. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, Apollonia in Italy, I mean, it's like kind of an arranged marriage, you know, it's more in a society that, you know, that doesn't, you know, empower women as much, you know, but she yeah. was, the, but she was the one who was, you know, who had more power in Michael's relationship than Kay did. And Kay was the, you know, the liberated yet manipulated one.
Yeah. So I think liberated women come from traumatic backgrounds, and then they get into relationships that recreate that dynamic. And then all of a sudden they're recreating the cycles that they knew and used to be a part of, instead of living in this new space, right? They become liberated because of a desperation, because of a need, and then they fall back into the old cycle and they lose themselves. That's really what I see of Kay.
I do think, though, that the time in Italy was also like a germinating period for him to become more of who he was, because I think he learns that by using his family name, and not just the family name, but also the hint of violence, like the kind of undertone of the threat of violence, that he can get whatever he wants.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, he was able to marry that girl. Well, what did he say? Like, wouldn't it be better to gain a son-in-law than to lose a daughter? And like, well, that's a creepy thing to tell the guy whose daughter you want to date, right?
Yeah.
like, we can get married, or, you know, your daughter could disappear. So what would you prefer, sir? So by, I think, like, he learns that he has an enormous amount of power while he's there. And then he comes back and you know, things unfold. Anyway, if we're going to get you to the Nibble Mountains, which is what Tetons means, well, we probably need to keep moving.
Nipple? Really?
Yeah, it's French for nipple.
I thought it was French for Tetons.
That's what I thought, too.
Well, you can look it up. But
I'll
anyway, enjoy your Booba Mountains. So,
yeah.
Oh, I will.
Are you guys want to talk about Triple R?
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay. I think we can actually get to this really quick, because this movie does not require the the analysis that The Godfather does.
Oh, really?
Man.
Yeah. So I'm going to try and get through this summary real quick. So you have a village where a young girl is kidnapped by the British colonists. John, what language did you watch this in?
It started in Portuguese.
Did you switch to Hindi?
I switched to Hindi, yeah.
Okay. For a while, I thought, why are they making the Portuguese the bad guys in this film? And why do they look so British, right?
The Portuguese, it sounded like... I felt like the Portuguese was like had an Indian accent to it or something.
Yes,
like,
it did. It was so confusing.
Yeah,
I didn't Portuguese know I had the option to change, or I would have changed languages.
Anyway, the point is that they stole this girl, and then we meet... So there's two guys. There's Raju and there's Beam. So we meet Raju. He's a soldier for the British, and his introduction to us is that he's asked to go arrest a guy who's in a crowd of like 3,000 men, and he fights his way through that crowd, even though his skull is like smashed open multiple times. But he brings the guy back, and so he earns the respect of the British, but they don't promote him to special officer, which is a real bummer. And then we learn that Beam is the guy from the village who is sent to rescue the girl. Her name is Molly. And our introduction to him is he's capturing a wolf. Is it a wolf?
Tiger.
No. It starts as a wolf. He starts trying to capture the wolf.
Starts as a wolf. But, well, okay. He starts...
The point
he's
is...
He's chasing a wolf, and then he captures a tiger.
He's gathering a zoo, and we'll get to that. but we meet him bare-chested capturing a tiger, and it's so awesome. And so that's our introduction to the two of them. And we now know that these two are... in opposite, because Beam is going to go rescue the girl, and Raju has been told that someone has come, and he needs to discover this person because he has to stop this plot. So we know they're opposed, and they meet each other head on at this accident that has happened on this bridge, and there's this kid in the water who is going to get burned to death, and Raju's on top of the bridge, and Beam is on the shore, and they get each other's attention. They wave, nice friendly wave, and then
wordlessly.
And then they use this weird sign language for that basically means, I'm going to tie myself to the rope, and you're on the same rope, and I'm on a horse, and you're on a motorcycle, and we're going to launch off opposite sides of the bridge and swing underneath with a flag. And we're going to save the kid, and then we're going to clasp hands, and it's going to be the most awesome thing you've ever seen until they land in the water and they're sprinting towards each other underwater for the greatest sprint towards each other moment I've ever seen in a film ever. Ever. And now they're best friends. These guys are best friends while Raju is still looking for the guy who's going to try and take the girl back, and Beam is trying to find the girl. Beam, in the meantime, falls in love. Luckily enough, with a girl who can get him into the palace, and Raju discovers who Beam really is. He only does it because I think he captures Beam's best friend, and he interrogates him, and he notices Beam's best friend's got a necklace. But Beam's best friend throws a snake at him, bites him, and he's going to die for sure, except Beam brings him back to life with a poultice or of some sort or spit. But he notices... the same necklace, so he knows that his best friend is also the traitor. So he heals super fast and gets to the palace in time to thwart the greatest attack I've ever seen in a movie ever, as Beam shows up with a zoo. And it's not just that the animals start killing the British, but Beam is constantly picking up and throwing deadly animals at the British. And it's just incredible. It's incredible. But he is thwarted because Raju shows up and stops him. And Beam is captured. Now, what we learned is a quick backstory part where we learned that Raju, his whole village was kind of massacred by the British, and his father told him, one day you need to get a gun into every hand of everyone in our village so you can fight back. And so Raju's not a bad guy. He's been a sleeper. He's playing the long game. He needs to get promoted to special agent so that he can be in charge of a shipment of guns. And now he is a special agent, but he can't, until he gets that assignment to ship the guns, he can't break character. So he whips Beam in front of a whole bunch of people. And the British lady, who I don't know why she's carrying around like the worst whip you've ever seen in your life.
Oh my God.
But she's like, use this one instead. Also, show the damage it does on the pole and then whip him.
Ugh.
But Beam refuses to kneel and he sings a song and there's a riot that is put down. But Raju decides that Beam could get the people on his side with just a song. He doesn't need to wait for guns anymore. He just needs he needs the right people, right? And so he helps Beam escape, and Beam is, I think, takes Molly back at that point too, right? Right, Beam escapes from Molly when hanging.
Sometimes, because Molly's with them when they're hiding out in the in Sita's village.
Raju is now in solitary confinement, and they smash his knees, which is going to make this part coming up extraordinary. but so Beam realizes
his knees remain smashed and all the other parts of his body were unsmashed.
I know. So Beam runs into Raju's fiance, who is so pretty, man. But and she's also a wonderful, dedicated person. But she tells Beam who Raju is, and he's like, yeah, this is my fiance. This is his name, and he's been sacrificing for so long. And Beam realizes that, you know, that Raju only did what he did for the greater cause. And so Beam is off on his revenge / rescue mission. He does rescue Raju, and again, by use of Poultice on the knees, Raju is miraculously able to run around like he is in the Olympics. But before that, while his knees are healing up, he sits on Beam's shoulders and they fight like two little boys stacked on top of each other with a trench coat.
Yeah.
And it's wonderful. But then they finally attack the stronghold of the British guy, not before Beam gets in a motorcycle fight with someone, by which I mean he grabs a motorcycle with his hand and uses it as a club, just like the Simpsons.
There was a Simpsons episode where Homer does that with a bicycle.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. And so, well, I mean, they take out the British guy, right? And then there's the closing scene where lots of singing and dancing. But I guess the idea behind this movie was these are two legendary fighters from this era who never met, but what if they did, right? RRR stands for Rise, Roar, Revolt. And so, again, I don't know how much there is to dissect here, but this movie was immense. This movie was incredible. Like, my mouth was open for 70% of this film. And there were so many scenes where I'm like, oh my gosh, they can't possibly do anything crazier than this. And then they did. And so this movie was insane. This was a crazy movie, a crazy good movie. But anyway, discuss. Maybe end gent.
What can we?
I don't know what. So there's not much to say, is there? This movie
really,
was just a little
bit of trivia. This is, from my understanding, it stands for Rise, Roar, Revolt.
Yeah.
But I also read that it's RRR because the two main actors, they're like the two greatest, some of the greatest actors in India. Yeah, they're way high up. They're like, you know, they're the Tom Hanks or the Autumn Shank of India, right? The Nicolas Cage of India, perhaps. You know, they probably both are, but they're really, really popular, really big stars, and both their names start with R. And the director is a very, very popular director. Like, very. His name starts with R too. The director of this movie, of the five top grossing movies in India ever, he has three of them in the top five.
Is this one of them now?
And this is one of them. And so it's like the RRR is sort of a cheeky little, hey, can you believe all of us are coming together for this super movie?
Wow. So I do want to say the guy who plays Raju, right? So so where I am on like the sexual orientation scale, I think I'm like 5%. I'm far enough up that I enjoy going shopping for shoes with my wife. But yeah. Raju is such an incredibly hot man. Oh my goodness.
So hot.
So what do you think of Beam?
He's okay. He's kind of
so
goofy.
Hot.
Nah.
No, like there is something so delicious about Beam.
Really?
His face and those eyes and that smiling mix. Did you look at any of the like pictures of him not in the movie as well? Oh my gosh.
No, I didn't get that.
That man were to walk into a room and look at like just look at me sideways, I would like forget about women altogether. But, I don't know what would happen to me.
Okay, okay. But I just have to ask, but who do you prefer?
I put down Beam.
Beam?
As my like what's the award for like best guest? I put down Beam.
Oh.
Really?
We used to have a beefcake award. He'd probably win that one.
No, no, not Beam.
But I think Raju is great, right? But when it comes to like the person that you're gonna like be able to like really connect with and trust, and like I think you probably could with Raju too, but they're
I don't know, maybe the guy who can speak English.
That's true.
Or maybe his fiance.
Yeah.
I mean,
I don't know. So I will say though,
yeah, she's up there.
So
sorry.
I swear the Indian people they've perfected cuisine and human beauty. I think the Indian people are so gorgeous.
Yes.
It's just not even fair. So anyway. Anyway, I mean, what do you guys want to talk about with this movie? There was a whole lot of explosions, and there was a lot of the camera following the grenade arrow. This is like Rambo, except they actually strapped a grenade to the arrow.
Yeah.
It's like they were listening to our Star Trek podcast. We're like, can't you just beam grenades over somewhere else? They like totally utilized that. It's okay. I don't know what to say. I have a really hard time reckoning with, you know, because these are two actual historical figures, but the movie is so absurd.
Yeah.
And I think the fact that these two historical figures, I guess they were 20 years apart, I think that kind of helps, because it like if they were contemporaries, then I feel like the movie would have sort of a reality problem. But since you know they wouldn't have met each other in real life, it makes sense that they could, you know, kind of tongue in cheek historical, you know?
Wait, like, what you mean percentage this isn't of this entirely accurate?
It's strange to me that they put the names of two real people in this movie.
Oh.
Why? You know, for how weird of a movie it is and how absurd it is. And like, am I supposed to laugh or am I supposed to be pumped? I guess I'm both.
Oh man, this is like John. If Robert Hamburger were alive to see this, he would explode. So
they just needed ninjas to kill, I think.
Oh my goodness!
You didn't talk about. I just have to say it. There's no analysis involved, but there is a dance sequence in this, a dance off.
Yeah.
In this movie.
That Raju takes a dive.
Raju takes a dive, but it's like, you know, I was thinking about it. I was like, Michael Flatley's got nothing on this. Remember Michael Flatley, the Riverdance guy?
Oh, yeah.
But, it was so crazy. It was so great because the British are just like, oh, these dirty people, they can't do anything right. And then the British just can't back down from a dance-off that they know they're going to lose.
That's the best quote of the night. The British can't back off from a dance-off. Oh, man.
It's like all I have to do to stay ahead at this party is not get involved in a dance-off with these two guys. And actually, here's a question for you, because you know this might interfere with my FX award. Did they use any CG for the dancing? Like, is that
I don't think so.
I don't think so.
Because these two guys, I mean, they were perfectly in sync with each other for all the choreographed dancing. And there is a lot of it in this movie. Yeah. I suppose, the industry over there is, yeah. I mean, you might have to know your dance steps a little bit better than over here because, you know, we don't have as much dancing in our movies, I assume.
It's
maybe
a huge part of Bollywood films, right? And so I kind of feel like, would American films be better if the end credits of every American film were a giant dance production with the whole cast?
I hesitated just a little bit because I also heard that this technically isn't a Bollywood movie. Oh. And I assumed a Bollywood movie was just a movie that was made in India, but
and had
I
dancing
think,
in
you know,
the
actual – the actual Bollywood scene. Like, this is outside of the Bollywood scene, however you define that. Yeah.
So Bollywood movies are usually musical based. Yep. With a lot more, like, but the musical part is through the whole plot instead of just, like, specific moments.
I mean, I was kind of under the impression that, I mean, because like, Hollywood is a literal place. And not, obviously, it's not a Bollywood, but I think there's like some kind of Indian industry.
There is.
You know, that's, you know, kind of centered, you know, by certain companies or whatever. And so I think that's why this isn't technically classified as Bollywood.
Yeah.
So I don't know where Bollywood would be located, but my understanding is that India produces more movies than Hollywood does.
Right. Hollywood produces like 400 movies, and I think I heard that India produces like 1,800, or like Bollywood, or you know, something.
Amazing.
It's like, that's a lot.
Yeah, so Gonzo was right when he said he wanted to fulfill his dream of becoming an actor in Bombay. And right, do you remember that from the Muppet movie? And Fozzie said, "You don't go to Bombay to become an actor; you go to Hollywood." And Gonzo says, "If you want to do it the easy way, but it sounds like you've got a better chance of making a movie in Bollywood because they make four times as many."
Bollywood is the hard way because, you know, because you're working more.
Because the food's really good and all the people are beautiful.
Because there's so many movies to be in.
Yeah, it's true.
I mean, it's got to be a lot harder to stay fit in Bollywood with all that amazing food around.
That's true, especially if you're a Muppet. I don't know, whatever.
A Muppet.
So we are straying. Brooke, I am doing my best to get you out of here by 8 p.m.
No, I'm enjoying this. You let us enjoy this.
Okay. No, so
but what can honestly, we say about the movie?
I don't know.
I think the movie is incredible.
Yeah, I would love to hear your impressions because this was a movie that on your guys' podcast, Andy wanted to push and Melissa was like, no freaking way, right?
Right. And afterwards we discussed it and like I said to Andy, I was like, I wish Melissa would watch it. And he said, if she's going to be in her own way, she doesn't deserve to watch it.
Okay.
So,
okay.
Melissa, if you're listening, sorry, Andy, I just threw you under the bus.
Melissa was with us our last podcast, as you all have heard. And we talked about it a little bit because we hadn't watched RRR yet. And she said she didn't want to watch it because, you know, I can't remember her words. Sorry, Melissa, I don't want to misquote you. But now I ask, would Melissa have liked this movie? I still don't know.
Yeah.
I don't think she would have. I think it's very similar to kind of how she imagined it would be. And, she said it's like, you know, I'm a little bit sick of this. And I know I definitely enjoy the movie more than she kind of said she would have enjoyed it. But I do get... Like, if you don't want to see just the bro-ness of a movie, a lot of bro-ness, and I can understand why you wouldn't want to see a lot of bro-ness, then it's not the movie for you. So yep. I understand if you're annoyed while watching this movie. Yeah.
I don't deal well with violence in movies, which makes all of these really interesting picks. But... I remember there were certain points at which, like, I was messaging with JB, and I was like, I can't watch the screen right now. But everything is in subtitles. So, like, I don't know what I'm missing. This is so much.
So there was that shot at the very beginning, right, where Molly's mother was clubbed in the side of the head with a tree. And I thought, this is going to be a graphically violent film. And I think that probably was just about the worst of the whole film, except for maybe the flogging.
The whipping. The flogging scene. And then just the other torture scenes, too. Like, those are just hard on me. I'm just sensitive to them. But that being said, I felt like, and violent killing of people as he runs through the mob of people trying to break down the fence. And there's a lot in this one for me. But I still, it was... It's interesting because it's not like it's one of those movies that about friendship and love and things that you come out of it like Dead Poets Society. You don't get those kind of feels from it, right?
Yeah.
But the feelings that I got from it, which I felt was like really similar between all three of these movies, again, maybe because they got lucky, maybe on purpose, but it's this idea of We are all fighting our own fights, and we are all standing in our own way. Mm. And how powerful it is in each one of these movies when the characters get out of their own way and start working in collaboration, either with the family in The Godfather or with Raju and Beam together, or when they finally have some honesty in The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent of who they're fighting, like as soon as they get out of their own way and connect more like honestly, so much happens.
I will say, if so, IMDb, when you IMDb always has the parental guide, right, for movies, and in this one for violence and gore, it says severe, and that's not a lie. And so, I mean, there, one of the sections is there are many deadly animal attacks.
I think it's PG-13 equivalent, though.
Is it
many?
I think, yeah. I mean. Because there's this weird thing that happens that when you kill one person in a movie, it's kind of a big deal. But, you know, when 300 people are killed, like, in the same scene, it's kind of fine. And one thing I can commend about this movie, and, I mean, if you don't like this movie, this is an excellent reason to dislike the movie. Like, Roy, what you mentioned at the beginning of, you know, when, you know, Molly's mom gets clubbed in the head with the thing – and then later you have that really absurd dance off, and then, you know, then you have the zoo attack sequence, and then you have the torture scene on the gallows, and then you have the flashback where the father is telling the son to load and shoot, you know, while the son watches his father die and stuff like that. Okay, can we just get some tone consistency here? Or maybe not, because it's like I watch this movie and it's like the tone and the feel and like how I'm supposed to feel is like, am I supposed to take this as a joke or am I supposed to take it as a serious drama? It strangely does both things without me minding so much. Hmm. Like another movie, I could totally see myself just being like, oh, you know,
pick get a lane. It straight.
Yeah, pick a lane. With this one, I'm kind of like, you know what? You're all over the road. Let's see where this goes. Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks.
Forward. Yeah.
You're the fun uncle.
Yeah, it's a fun uncle.
We don't know if we're going to crash or make it to the reunion, but you're fun.
It's like, is our uncle drunk or is he on some kind of pills?
It was a real life experience, recalling.
Oh, really?
Gosh. It's so fun.
All right. Well,
this movie is it's like you talked about Dead Poets Society. I consider that movie a 2-hour hug. I consider this movie kind of a 2-hour high five.
Sort of with the occasional punch to the groin.
Right. Right?
I thought that this movie is like a 3-hour hazing.
Okay.
Like you're constantly getting hazed. Like, okay. And this is going to bring us all together and we're going to be like a really great sorority afterwards. But right now I just feel like you are spraying me in the face with the hose of flogging. And I don't appreciate it.
I think the movie could have ended with the flogging scene because I think we could have gotten to the point where Raj realizes that it's like, okay, you know what? The guns that I've been betraying my people for this whole time and, you know, doing the long game and doing all this stuff, that's not as important. It's not as big a weapon as the people. And, like, this inspiration is more important. And it could have ended with – like, because I thought the movie was ending, but there were 57 minutes left in the movie.
Yeah, because
I paused it there for 4 days, by the way.
Really?
It took me a while to come back.
See, oh, because yeah, that's a pretty brutal part. But the crowd overcoming the British oppressors in that scene, that could have been the end of the movie.
Yeah, and I thought, oh, he's going to reveal that he's on Beam's side and he's going to free him here, and this is the revolt that happens now. But thank heavens that didn't happen, because the reveal to Beam that Raju is a good guy and then the rescue is amazing.
That scene like made war part of the awards for me. Ooh, and I really didn't know where they were going to go with it either. I was really like, where do we go now?
Yeah.
So we already know he's a good guy. So how are they going to, and the way that they did it, I thought was really, really brilliant. I would like to say that the 3-hour hazing, like I was appreciative to be brought in. Like, I'm not saying I don't like this movie. I felt
you're part of the frat now.
Anxiety and like PTSD from it all at the end of it. But I loved this movie.
Mm.
Oh, good. Good.
Well, but right. It was not a hug. It wasn't a hug.
All right, Brooke. You ready to take
Unless
us through?
Unless you hug a tree with a flogger with spikes on it.
Hug a tree with your face? Are you ready to take us through The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent?
Yeah. Are you guys ready for it?
Woo woo!
Because, ooh, like, this is what I was made for my whole life.
Okay.
Okay.
Are you going to read for us?
Am I going to read for you? No.
Yeah. Like, you know what? No. I am going to read for you.
I am going to read for you. Let me tell you. Let me tell you. So, I would like to say to those of you who didn't hear me nominate this movie, I nominated it because there were these two girls in the airport who were like, that movie's just over the top and it's so dumb. I think they were trying to do something and they didn't do it. They effing did it. They made me like Nicolas Cage, whom I don't really like. I don't know that I have laughed harder in a movie in decades.
Oh, wow.
What?
I was laughing. What? I was in tears. This movie broke me. I thought it was brilliant and amazing. So Nicolas Cage, this movie starts off with Nicolas Cage arguing with Nicolas Cage.
Oh, yeah. Nicky.
Isn't that the first Nicky?
Nicolas arguing with Nicky. Nicky's constantly punching Nicolas in the face.
It's so great. Everything about this movie is brilliant. So we see Nicolas Cage and he's like needing a role and he's trying to like argue with himself about the role and how to get the role. And he goes to this lunch and then he asks if he needs to do a reading. And the guy's like, no, you don't need to do the reading. He's like, yeah, but I'm Nick Cage. He's like, you know what? I'm going to do the reading. And then he gets done with the reading and they're like, wow, man, you're Nick Cage. And then he doesn't get the part. And so he starts to have a little bit of a come apart. And he is with his daughter, who I think, well, actually, the movie starts with another girl watching a Nicolas Cage movie and getting kidnapped.
Yeah.
I forgot that. That's a pretty pivotal part of this movie plot. And so then we cut to Nicolas Cage and he's at therapy with his daughter first and he's explaining their relationship. And his daughter is sitting on the couch just watching it. And she keeps looking at the therapist and going, see? What have I told you? Like, this is, like, and the therapist is just like, Nick, can't you see this? And he's like, no. She wanted to watch those movies. So he's like trying to get through this explanation with his daughter and his daughter is just not having it. And he keeps talking over her to in this very specific way that makes me feel like maybe Nicolas Cage is autistic. I don't know. Is he spectrum-y or is he just completely unaware and self-delusioned? And it could go either way. But they go back to his ex-wife's house afterwards and the daughter is frustrated and walks in and his wife asks him to please show up for his daughter's birthday. And he's like, of course I will. It's my daughter. Of course I'll be there for the birthday. So then he goes back to the hotel that he's living at and we find out that he's out of money. He's raised this huge bill by living in a hotel through his divorce process and not doing anything about it. And he's talking to his agent about a gig earlier in the movie. I'm sorry, I'm not doing a very good job summing this movie up.
No, you're fine. Yeah.
You can
and he learns that he lost the part.
He learns that he lost the part and he accepts a role.
A gig, it's not even a role.
An invitation.
Right? A birthday party appearance.
Yeah, an invitation to come to a birthday party during his daughter's. Well, he learned that he lost the role during his daughter's birthday party and he makes a huge scene and plays a song because he gets drunk. And then later he's like, all right, I'm locked out of my hotel. I have to accept this gig to do a guest appearance at a birthday party in Majorca. And so he takes it, he gets on the plane, he goes out there, and at this point, he is meeting for the first time Pedro Pascal's character, Javi. but he doesn't know he's meeting Javi. And as he's on the flight on the way over there, we see that there's a CIA agent, two of them, talking and waiting for his plane to land. Because whomever is on this plane is going to be going to the drug lord's house, and they're going to try to plant something on him. And when Nicolas Cage walks off, we get to see Tiffany Haddish's character plant a bug on a tracker on him,
yeah,
by making like a fawning over him, basically, and putting this tracker on him. And so, and then he meets Javi. He goes on a boat, and he's kind of ignoring him the whole way. And he gets to the property, and he's like trying to figure out who the heck this Javi guy is that he's going to be doing a birthday for. And he finds out that it's the guy he's been with all along. So he goes through, Javi is totally fanboying over him. And while he's there, the CIA agent contacts him and says, "Hey, you are now a plant for us. We're going to use you to get information on this guy, 'cause he's a drug lord and he's kidnapped this woman." And the whole time Nick Cage is like, "No, you don't know this guy. I've met him. He's great. I really like this guy," because he's a fanboy, right? And so we go on this hysterical heist of Nick Cage being talked into planting a bug in the house and trying to get information on Javi, who he doesn't believe is the drug lord, but who the CIA says, yes, it is. And so then they start manipulating Nick Cage to do all these things under the fear of what if this had happened to his own daughter. And Nick is constantly trying to talk himself out of what he believes is true and listening to the CIA agents, while at the same time planning a movie with Javi. They're writing out the basis and plot of a movie that Javi wants Nick Cage to star in. And so they continue to talk through these different things. Nick's trying to find out if the girl is on the property. He gets led into a magic room where he sees that Javi has all of this memorabilia about him. And at one point, Nick Cage uses drug tape on his hands that he could have used to drug someone else with, but accidentally drugs himself with, which is probably one of my favorite scenes of the whole movie. I was literally in tears at this point. And we also see that Javi has, you know, the golden guns from Face Off. In fact, a whole, what do you call it? Wax figure.
Like, I don't think it's a wax figure. Nick Cage wax figure.
Yeah, this grotesque wax figure of Nick Cage, and it's holding the guns, which will come into play later as they go through all of their hijinks of feeling like someone is after them and running away, and they're both high and enjoying.
Oh, man, that scene is
scenery.
So great.
Like, really
should
is.
There be a part in the movie where we're paranoid? Yeah, right.
they're writing there again. They're writing what they know. They're getting really lucky, but they go through, and at the end, Nick finds out. Javi brings in Nick's family as a gift to him, but Nick thinks he's done it because he's on to him, because they realize that they've been busted, and Javi still doesn't know because he's not actually the drug lord. And so in a big reveal, we find out that it is not Javi, but his uncle. Is that right?
I don't know. It's the guy
that
with
the
cousin.
His cousin, yeah.
Cousin,
Javi's
uncle.
Father was the major drug guy. And I think he,
when Javi's father died, he knew that it wasn't going to be Javi that died.
Yeah. He's like, first of all, Javi's the Fredo of the family.
He's
second
the Fredo.
Of all, everyone's expecting Javi to be the drug guy. So it was like a misdirection.
He's the face. He's the face of the crime organization, but he doesn't actually do anything.
And it's his cousin. Yeah. Lucas.
Yeah, Lucas. Yeah.
Lucas Gutierrez is the, and so then we find out that Javi's a good guy and Nick is a good guy, and they start trying to work together. They trade shoes with each other as they're both about to go out into the wilderness and kill each other. And then they realize that it's Lucas, and the, you know, they get the getaway car and they run away and they save the women, and who have now been, Nick's family has been hijacked and part of the kidnapping scene. So they go through all of their very hilarious getaway tactics, and in the end, Javi gets to be with the girl of his dreams.
Yay.
And Nick gets to produce the movie of his dreams, and they all go back and they make this bestseller, and things are good because everyone at the end of the movie realizes that Paddington 2 is the best movie ever made. It brings them all together.
And the movie they make is called Chubby Rain.
Right? Oh, no. But don't you love that when they're talking about the three best movies of all time and his number three movie is like Paddington 2? It's like, are you kidding me? He's like, I cried throughout the entire movie. It made me a better man. And then they watch it together.
True.
And then at the end of it,
it is Paddington 2. And then as they're going home, Nick's daughter looks at him and he's like, he says to her, you can pick the movie. And she says to him, have you seen Paddington 2?
Yeah.
And my whole heart exploded in that moment.
I'm assuming you noticed at the very end when he crashes into the embassy that before they throw the knife to him for the miraculous rescue, right? That it's all of a sudden it's no longer his wife, it's Demi Moore?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they're going into this, they're like going into the very last scene of how they get away and how they crash, like you said, they crash through this gate going into the embassy to get away from Lucas. And as you're watching it in the audience, you're like, oh my gosh, what is happening? And it cuts, there's a scene cut, and all of a sudden it's different actors because they are sitting in a theater watching the movie that they've made about their real life. Yeah.
So now, I don't know if this, I think this movie is trying to pull off a gimmick. And so this is, John and I talked about the movie Adaptation, which is a Nicolas Cage movie. What's the guy's name? Kaufman?
Charlie Kaufman, the writer, who's famous. We've talked about him on Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Famous.
Yes.
So the idea behind Adaptation is it's a movie about a screenwriter who's writing a movie about adapting some lady's book, right? About irises or whatever.
The Orchid Thief.
I did. Okay, hold on. When you asked me if I had seen this movie, I said no.
But you've seen it?
Because I have seen it, and I hated it, and it made me want to like blow up the whole world for the fact that this movie had even been made, and I thought it was the worst thing.
So I find that
besides
fascinating.
Besides, as good as it gets.
I find that fascinating because I think that Adaptation and this movie are extremely alike. Because in Adaptation, right, you think you're watching a movie about a guy who's writing a movie, but you realize that you've been watching the movie the whole time, right?
I don't think I ever caught on to that.
Oh, well, I mean, because he ends up writing the movie about himself, and like at some point, I don't know where the transition is, but at some point you realize, oh, I've been watching the movie. And so let me ask you about The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent. How much of this movie is real life for the actor, and how much of it is the movie? Because I think there's a couple ideas here. It's possible that it's only the movie at the very end when Demi Moore is switched out, and it's also possible that it's only real life after it shows them in the movie theater. The entire thing up to that point.
No.
Here's what I think.
That's interesting, but no. It was just them watching. It was just a transition. That's how I took it. I wouldn't.
So everything was biographical up until they transitioned into the movie theater.
Well, this didn't really happen to Nicolas.
No, I know that.
I think that Nicolas Cage is such that his whole life is a movie to him at all times. So, like, we're seeing this through his lens while he is also arguing with Nikki, right? So, like, is it the real lens of what happened? Is it his perception of what happened? I think it's all the actor's life. And so maybe some of this didn't actually happen in real life.
I took it just like
Bowfinger. But it did happen to him.
Like Bowfinger. So, but here's what I think, though, and because part of me thinks that this entire movie was the movie because the plot gets ridiculous. Like the CIA, right? Like that's ridiculous. And what really strikes me is how bad his relationship was with his family before he left to Majorca or Mallorca or whatever you want to call it. And then after the movie's over, they're hanging out at home. They're best friends. He still loves his wife or ex-wife or whatever she is. He's having an easy conversation with his daughter. They're right as rain, right? And I kind of feel like that's been the relationship the whole time, but we've simply been watching the movie.
No, but it is a movie that we're watching.
Well, I know that because I had to pay for it, but
I mean, well, no, I'm afraid I don't understand because you didn't do that. It's like they lived the, I thought the whole movie was, okay, Nicolas Cage has this crazy experience and then he makes a movie about the crazy experience that we see part of at the end.
But so Javi is now like can just wander around the United States and he had no legal action as far as
I didn't
being
say
as
it was
major.
A good movie we watched.
Okay.
I may disagree with some people here.
No, I just think that as soon as he got to Majorca, it started to become a Nicolas Cage movie. Like everything in it was, and then they started talking about how, well, this should be in the movie. Well, what about adding this to the plot? And the things they were talking about, they did, and they started to happen. And so
it really felt a lot more like the people making this movie who it was like I felt like it was way more of a reflection of the people making this movie talking about how great a Nicolas Cage movie is than the movie going the other direction.
Okay. So I will say this. I thought Pedro Pascal was so good in this movie.
He is really good.
He's so good.
Yeah.
So did you guys not like this movie?
Well, we'll get to that.
We'll get there. Yeah. We'll...
All right.
I will say I'm not going to answer your question, but I will say big missed opportunity on this movie.
So what's the missed opportunity, John?
I think – okay, and I'm going to do something that I hate doing in saying what I would have preferred. And the big thing is –
Studio
you know,
notes?
This is my studio notes. The big issue I had with this movie is I really felt – I couldn't get it out of my mind that some bro – you know, and we're talking about bros again. Some bro was like, wouldn't it be cool if I made a Nicolas Cage movie and I got Nicolas Cage to star as himself in the movie and it was a very Nicolas Cage-like movie. And so he totally did that. But they got Nicolas Cage. They could have made Nicolas Cage the normal person in the movie, like a human being, and not like, hey, could you act more like Nicolas Cage? Can you act like Andy Samberg impersonating Nicolas Cage? Can you act like Nicolas Cage impersonating Napoleon Dynamite by saying gosh and saying dumb things all the time? I think if everybody else was the insane person and it's like Nicolas Cage, this is Nicolas Cage's chance to be like, okay, yeah, my life is crazy. I'm an actor. I work, but I'm also a human being and I don't act like Nicolas Cage in Nicolas Cage movies all the time. It could have said a lot more about Nicolas Cage rather than just making another Nicolas Cage movie.
So I think,
he really is the actor Nicolas Cage in all things at all times?
I don't know.
That's the only way that I can have resolution with him as an actor being that bad.
So I don't know.
Is that he really thinks that
Even if he is that, it's more interesting to portray him as someone more human than who we always play.
It sounds like John.
I don't think he deserves more interesting.
It sounds like John.
You really dislike Nicolas Cage. That's really weird that you love this movie so much.
I know.
So John, it sounds to me like you wanted this to be JCVD.
I never saw JCVD. I don't know what that is.
Because that's like the Jean-Claude Van Damme movie where like his character, he's really playing himself and he's like, this is who I really am as a person and I'm really normal and crazy things happen around me in this movie, but I'm a really normal person, right? And so like in this movie, Nick Cage had been the normal person. Now I have no idea what Nick Cage is like in real life. And in like the interviews is like, he said, I wasn't interested in doing this movie until the idea was, well, I wouldn't be playing myself. I'd be playing Nick Cage. I'd be playing like this character. So he's not trying to be realistic to his own life. But then it also feels kind of so pretentious for him to say, right, that he's come up with this treatment on a spoof of himself or whatever. But so I have no idea what he's like in real life. But I still feel like, and I don't think it has to be that we're watching a movie all the way through until the very end. But I think there's a transition at some point in the film where that really does happen. But it's so, I don't know. If you're watching this movie thinking you're getting an insight into who Nicolas Cage really is, I don't think this movie is that.
You know what I think? I think he was, if they had done this movie, for instance, with, what's his name?
Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Meet the Fockers.
Oh, Ben Stiller?
Ben Stiller. If they had done this movie with Ben Stiller, I would have hated it. Because Ben Stiller would have just been Ben Stiller the whole time. And I really don't believe, like, I really, if there's any actor I hate more than Nicolas Cage, it's Ben Stiller.
Oh.
And I have heard that he's a really good person, and I don't believe it. But, like, if I had been hanging out, like, actually in person with Nicolas Cage, as Nicolas Cage, while this was happening to him and he was acting this way, I would have felt very much like I was hanging out with Ben Stiller in any of his movies when he is his own freaking problem in everything that he does. And he's just, like, the most pathetic, like, sniveling, I create my own problems and blame the rest of the world for it person. Somehow,
it's like
they
have
made
feelings
this movie
about Ben Stiller
with Nicolas Cage without it becoming Ben Stiller and still being funny and entertaining. And so I was like, I could see Nicolas Cage actually being this person all the time. Yeah. And right now, because I get to laugh at it, and like with, for some reason, it was endearing. It was charming to me. And I was like, I can accept all of his other movies being as bad as they are, because if he's just being himself and this is himself, then he's not really, it's not really that he's like choosing to be a bad actor. He's just being him. And
but
this is funny.
But we're right back to square one. It's like, okay. If he's just acting the way we expect him to act, then, you know, there's no real way to go. Like, the way I picture it is like,
then
hey,
Mickey loses.
Nicolas Cage is an actor and, you know, he's in debt and he has to take all these things and he gets all this pressure from everybody to be like Nicolas, Nick Cage out, freak out in your Nick Cage way. And if all the characters in the movie were constantly like, hey, could you cage out here? Could you cage out here? And he's pushing back with being like, I'm not like, I wish you would consider me a real person rather than, you know, someone you could laugh at.
So
I think that's much more interesting.
You do have that moment though, right?
You're right. No, it would be much more interesting.
But not as funny. And but so you have that moment where Javi takes him to the cliff, right? And Javi is like, come on, be Nick Cage, right? And Nick and Nick Cage is pushing back against that. And he's like, come on, this is ridiculous. But then, like, Nick Cage gives in. And as soon as he gives in, he's, like, happy, right? And it
see, it doesn't work for me because Nicolas Cage is so much like Nicolas Cage in every other scene beside the movie. Except for one.
Yeah.
When Nicolas Cage is, you know, talks to his agent and he's kind of like he's collapsing in the hallway and he's like, I'm giving up acting. And he leaves a message for his agent saying, you know, please tell everybody it was an honor to be, you know, a part of this, you know, this thing. Like, that was actually my favorite Nicolas Cage acting moment because it was just like, okay, you know what? I'm giving up being Nicolas Cage. I'm giving up being absurd. And he's just so resigned. And that's the guy I wanted to see for the rest of the movie rather than the buffoon.
So, but I feel like if we had an opportunity to sit down with Nick Cage and just hang out, that eventually he is going to bring the conversation around to shamanic acting. Like, that is exactly what the real Nick Cage would want to talk about, right? So,
well, I mean, I really appreciated that he wasn't a vampire. And I don't know why it gave me so much joy.
No, it was I liked this movie. It was an enjoyable movie.
I feel like, John, like, you are not wrong. It would have been much more interesting and really impactful. It would have been like a statement piece on humanity and how we like have all these people that we idolize but refuse to see them as real people. And like, it would have been like really important and it could like illustrate the damage that we've done to people like Britney Spears and like these virgins that we idolize and toss out. And like, but for some reason, I loved it exactly as it was.
Yeah, no, this
is. And I wouldn't change it. And I was so glad to see Nick Cage being this Nick Cage through the whole movie that I was like, I forgive him.
Yeah, no.
I forgive him adaptation. That's honestly what I was thinking.
You're a
bigger
Nicolas Cage fan now than I am now.
I was literally thinking about adaptation and how much I hated that effing movie because, one, I missed big parts of it and should go back and rewatch it. But, as I was watching this movie, I was like, I forgive him for that.
See, at the very end of the movie, near the end of the movie, when they're talking about the script, this is definitely when I was thinking about adaptation. Javi and Nicolas Cage are saying, our movie should start out as an interesting character piece and then become a Hollywood blockbuster, which is exactly what this does. And interestingly, that's exactly what adaptation does, kind of as a satire. You know, in this, to an extent, I think, you know, the creators, if they would call this a satire too, but no, really, they're indulging and bro-ing out in it. But adaptation is the exact same way, because it is Nicolas Cage talking to himself. In adaptation, it's Charlie Kaufman, the writer of the movie, talking to his twin brother Donald Kaufman, who looks exactly like him, but who doesn't actually exist in real life. And they're having, you know, the kind of argument at the beginning. It's like, okay, what should we make? Should we make this, you know, really interesting internal piece? But Donald Kaufman, his alter ego, is a very successful screenwriter who, you know, just does the Hollywood, you know, the Hollywood trash, you know, that you can love or hate, or, you know, however you define it. But the movie adaptation actually does become like an action picture by the end of it, in the same way. And it's kind of weird that I haven't heard a lot of people comparing adaptation to this movie as much as I would have thought, and it's kind of funny that Roy and I we were thinking that this whole time, because I haven't heard a lot of, you know, dialogue on that. But adaptation is a very old movie.
So, but, and I think to the point, like, if this movie had been like the serious look at what it really is like to be Nicolas Cage in a world that insists he act like the Nicolas Cage that he's not really, but that everyone expects, right? If that had been the movie, then to the point, not very many people would have watched it, even if it had been a good movie.
Hear me now and believe me later. I didn't want it that way because it would have been more serious and more important and more pretentious. I wanted it that way because it would have been funnier if that were the case. It would have been funnier if Nicolas Cage was the only normal person in this movie and he was acting differently than we expected him to.
So this movie, though, turned into a Nicolas Cage blockbuster movie, right? That's how the movie ends, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, I don't know that I could have handled it being funnier.
Oh. Well, that's the unbearable weight of massive talent, huh? Do you guys want to know a little bit about these movies as far as numbers? You know, The Godfather cost $6 million, but it made $250 million.
It's a big movie.
Yeah.
Over a lifetime, or?
So that's box office numbers. Theaters. Yeah. So
now, it was definitely the biggest movie of the year, yeah. I know.
Now, RRR. Would you believe that movie only cost $44 million to make? That's astonishing to me.
I know. Oh,
wait, really? I heard it was really expensive.
That's what the budget I get from IMDb.
Maybe it's just American dollars, but also you have to add in all the Indian dollars.
All the rupees. So, yeah. And they made $100 million. Now, The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent lost $1 million. It cost $30 million and it made $29.
So that makes it funnier.
Yeah. If we're talking prestige, all of these movies are fresh. The Godfather is a 97, which is not a surprise. The Unbearable Weight is an 86 on Rotten Tomatoes. And Triple R is a 92, which is that's pretty high for an insane action bro fest. So,
and also it's pretty high, because if you want to dislike RRR, then it gives you so much room to dislike it, you know. for the tone reason alone, for the glorification, for the, you know, the intensity, for, you know, this, you know, you could call the violence senseless because it is, you know, you can decry it, you can protest it, you can say, you know, this movie doesn't say anything when it's trying to, you can say it's, or you can say it says too much when it should be a popcorn thing. Like, there's so much room to dislike the movie, but I guess that's kind of one of the reasons why it's good.
Yeah. All right, John, is now a good time for a commercial break?
Commercial break. Hey, everybody out there, listen to Yours, Mine, and Theirs, the podcast you're listening to right now. Go to iTunes, give us 5 stars. It's Yours, Mine, and Theirs, 5 stars, or Apple Podcasts, I guess is what it's called. Send us an email at yoursmindtheirspodcast@gmail.com. Go ahead and go to our blog at yoursmindtheirspodcast.blogspot.com. From there, you can download all of our MP3s directly, just in case Apple Podcasts doesn't have the one you're looking for. We go right back to the beginning where we talked about True Grit and The Thing and stuff like that. Also, give us a call at 801-896-4542. 801-896-4542. Find us on Facebook. That's where you get the most action because that's where our polls are, where you decide. That's right, you, the listener, decide what we listen, what we watch, be it genre or specific movie. Or if you want to make yourself known there, make friends with us, you, yes, you, can join us as a guest on Yours, Mine, and Theirs.
Yeah, if you're ready for your life to be changed forever, it's an opportunity.
Yes, forever.
Yeah.
Okay, how comfortable are you guys?
Oh, I do not require a comfort break, but if you guys need to, that's fine.
I think I'm quite comfortable right now.
Quite.
Okay.
All right, let's do awards.
Yeah.
All right, Brooke, of these three, what is your favorite title?
It was The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent.
It's pretty long. Mm-hmm. It's got the most title. Mm-hmm. Roy?
I went with
is pretty good, but it does not come with a pronunciation guide, so I'm dismissing that. Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, I feel like if it were more unbearable for him, like the actual internal unbearable, I would have picked that. But I'm going to go with The Godfather because, well, that's what the movie was. Okay, Roy, best poster.
Okay, it's The Godfather. Very classic.
It's pretty good.
Very black.
Yeah. I agree. It's The Godfather.
I did the same.
It's Vito. Vito just standing there looking imposing, even though he's like 5 foot nothing, apparently. okay. Brooke, best opening credits.
I did RRR.
Good, good. That was, as part of the credits, you have the big disclaimer at the front saying, hey, this is fictional. Trust us. This is fictional. This didn't happen. That was a good little thing.
None of the tigers were killed.
Oh, and yeah, they said that at the very beginning. It's like none of the tigers were killed because they were all... It actually said that. All the tigers were CG. Something to say right at the beginning of the movie. Roy, best opening credits.
It's The Godfather. It's a classic.
I like The Godfather. It's just because the only credits is just the marionette logo of The Godfather, and that's it?
That's it.
Yeah. Okay, Roy, best technology.
Okay. Man, some honorable mentions. I know you guys, I don't want to steal anything from you guys, but I'm going to go with the two-man stacked fighting machine.
Okay. That's a weird technology. Yeah. Brooke, do you have a technology?
I mean, I think it's more technical than that, what you just said. I said the magic drug tape.
Ooh, yeah.
That was mine.
People from one side and not from the other.
Yeah, the magic drug tape that Nicolas Cage accidentally...
Drugs
just
himself with anyways.
Himself. Yeah, yeah. I, you know, another good technology, since you picked that, I'm going to pick the antidote of that.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Which is also something he used. And also, you know, Beam in RRR, he had the antidote for that snake bite that they said the antidote didn't exist, but he also, I think he had the antidote for being stabbed in the chest and crushed knees.
And crushed knees, he had the crushed knees. So my honorable mention was shattered bone healing poultice, or whatever you want to call it. Also grenade arrows.
Grenade arrows.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
Okay, Brooke, best outfit.
Best outfit. Where did I put that one? Oh. The grotesque Nicolas Cage statue and the golden guns.
Okay, that's good. Roy?
Well, honorable mention to Sita's green sari.
Yeah.
Which is just stunning.
But I'm going to give it to Vegas Fredo. No one Vegas is out like Fredo.
Oh, that's good. Okay, I am going to give an honorable mention to Nicolas Cage's faded yellow Vans.
Oh, yeah.
It's a good color on those. I thought I would like to get those, actually. It's a good color. But the winner is definitely Raju's, finally, his red officer suit.
Oh, yeah. Special officer outfit. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, Roy, best name.
Okay, so I went with Jack Waltz because that guy, you look at his face and the name Jack Waltz is the only name he possibly could have had. And it just fits perfectly.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, his mother named him. Just like when he popped out, it's like, oh, that's a Jack Bolt.
Yep.
Their name wasn't even Walt. Okay, Brooke, name.
I went with Beam because it sounds so sweet and cuddly and shiny, and he's going to kill you.
Yeah.
That was me editing my internal voice in real time.
Yeah. Well, it, you know, as long as you don't steal the one spoiled girl in the village, you're safe from being.
Yeah, he's a nice guy.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, my best name is honorable mention to Clemenza, probably one of my favorite people in The Godfather. I love that guy. And also in The Godfather, Apollonia, named after Prince's girlfriend in Purple Rain. but the winner is Captain McCluskey.
Captain McCluskey, yep. That's a good one.
Okay, Roy, best food.
Well, honorable mention to the veal Parmigiano Louise. I know people have feelings about veal. But
they said try the veal, yeah.
Yeah, I will, however, go with Fruit Loops. Man, I love cold cereal. Fruit Loops is a good one.
Fruit Loops from Unbearable Weight?
Yep.
Was that in? Okay. Brooke, best food.
I said the meal that Raju's fiance fed them after getting the police to leave.
Oh,
and they sit and have their conversation.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Tells them the story.
Where Beam said, do you have anything besides Indian food? All right. Flashback to Three Amigos.
Okay. Tapas?
Oh, that's what I was going to say. I was going to say in Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent at the very end, whatever they do, I wrote down in my notes. Obviously, I wrote down, I thought I was so funny. I was laughing at myself. I was like, their big plan is, hey, anybody see Amigo, Amigo, Amigo? Because it was just Nicolas Cage going around, like, talking people. So, okay, getting back to reality here. My best food is Clemenza sauce.
Mm.
You start with oil, you add the garlic, you add the tomatoes, you have the tomato paste, you stove in some sausage, meatballs, wine.
There was so much meat.
Sugar. Yeah.
It was like 20 pounds of meat that he'd shoved into that pot.
And you notice Clemenza is a perfect circle. So you know he does it right. Okay. Wait, did we all say favorite food?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Brooke, best alien.
I said old men in other people's countries.
Mm.
Okay, that's very good. Okay, Roy, best alien.
So similar. I went with Catherine Buxton, who is the sadistic British lady who just carries the whip around.
Right.
The nail gun whip.
She's a great alien. Yep. We'll hear more of her later. I went with Captain McCluskey. What's he doing hanging around with these Italians?
Mm.
Okay, Roy, best special effects.
Motorcycle fighting. It's pretty intense.
That's pretty good.
So I would also say at the very end where they use the three motions with their hands, which means you're going to jump off this ramp with the motorcycle and then I'm going to shoot it with my grenade arrow. That was a pretty good special effect. So
that was good. Okay, Brooke, which part of RRR is the most special effect?
How did you know that I just wrote RRR? the zoo fight.
The zoo fight. Yes, man.
That was mine. That was mine.
Synchronized zoo fighting.
Specifically when the curtain pulls up on that truck.
Yes, and they all jump off.
When he leaps from the truck with the flaming torch and all the animals are flanking him.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
What is happening there?
Yeah. I put an honorable mention in this category. It's not really a mention, but just, you know, shout out to the 386 Pandium that's just melting down to bring us the entirety of RRR. It's just working overtime, and it's just like a puddle of computer after the movie's over. Okay, Roy, best location.
I'm going to go with Majorca. Looks nice. Yes.
Me too.
Me too. I went specifically with the cliffs of Majorca.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it looks great.
I went... Yes, that's better than what I went with.
Did you have a specific place there?
The wall. In Majorca.
Oh, the wall.
Oh, the wall.
Okay, that's pretty good. That was my favorite part of the movie, by the way, so I'm glad you Brooke, best song.
Best song was, I'm going to say it wrong, Cormoran Bermudo. The one that Beam sings. during the flogging.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Kamuram Bemudu. First of all, his voice is gorgeous and amazing. And then the whole scene that they do around him singing that as he's it's so powerful. Mm.
Listed in the credits as flog song.
Flog song.
Is it really?
No, it's not.
I was about to say, you mean flog song.
Okay, Roy, best music, best song.
So honorable mention to Nick Cage composing extemporaneously a song called Sun Rising.
yeah.
But I'll give it to Johnny Fontaine singing I Have But One Heart at the wedding.
Oh, aww. Yeah, Johnny at the wedding, at Connie's wedding. Yep. Okay, I kind of wrote down all of RRR, question mark, because there's kind of music through the whole thing. But I kind of specifically went with the dance sequence, you know, where, Raj goes ahead and throws the, like pie tin on the drums and starts the drum beat, and then they do the dance contest, and they're saying, nacho, 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 nacho. Yeah. Oh. Roy, best guest.
Okay, because in The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, when they're in their living room after the movie has happened and his daughter's like, how did you get Demi Moore to play? I'm like, what? And I had to rewind and go back and like, and sure enough, there's Demi Moore. So happy guest star appearance for Demi Moore.
Okay, that's a pretty good guest star. Okay, Brooke, you
can pick.
Well,
I want to hear yours first.
I went with Diane Keaton, and I was going to check on this. You know, Diane Keaton is Kay, specifically because my guest star, I like to pick guests who we haven't seen yet.
Yeah.
And I think we haven't seen Diane Keaton in any other Yours, Mine, and Theirs movie, but I didn't verify that. So I was just on IMDb trying to verify this right now.
I'm pretty
now.
Sure you're right. I mean, we've only watched one Woody Allen so far. That's where I would expect to see.
Yeah, and she wasn't in that one. Yeah. So that's mine. I'm going to go with that one for now. So, Brooke, do you have anybody else?
Well, yeah, this category was a little confusing
to
me. I wasn't sure if I was doing it right, but I
can't do it wrong.
With Rama Rao Jr. with Beam.
Well, there you go.
Okay, Beam. Yeah, that's guest star.
He's never been in anything before.
That's true.
But he wasn't necessarily a guest of the movie. But
he's a guest to the podcast. So you can either do guest to the movie or guest to the podcast, or, you know, a guest to yourself, a personal guest. Okay, yeah, I'm going to stick with Diane Keaton, by the way. Brooke, while you're still talking, can we have your external recurring character? Now, this is another hard one, of course. This is someone who has appeared.
So, I'm going out on a limb here, and I'm saying Nicolas Cage.
Yes, Face Off.
Oh, yeah, Face Off.
Okay, I thought he had been in it, but I feel like he also was kind of in each of these movies.
Right, well...
Now that I know the connection DNA, to... to that, but then also, like, if the three R's of RRR are really that amazing, then they're kind of the Nicolas Cages of their Bollywood. Like, I feel like Nicolas Cage is kind of in all of them and in Face Off.
Well, there you go.
Okay, cool. Okay, Roy, who do you have for external?
Oh, there's so many. Because I don't want to steal your thunder, so I'll mention my winner, but then there's a few we need to talk about very quickly. So from Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb, General Ripper also plays McCluskey.
McCluskey. Oh, that's a good one. Okay. Okay, so that's your winner?
Yeah, who have you got?
Okay, I actually only wrote down one. It's like the first one I could think of, and it's Robert Duvall.
He's been in a ton of our movies.
I specifically put him down for To Kill a Mockingbird, which must have been just a few years before this, you know, where he kind of plays like this kind of teenage kid, Boo Radley. And then just a few short years later, I think less than a decade, he's
in his 40s. I don't know.
He's in his, like, he's super bald and he's the consigliere for the Don.
So he's also, he's Nick Pepper in True Grit. And he's also in Apocalypse Now, and he was Max Mercer in The Natural.
Oh, wow.
But I want to give a shout out to Joe Spinell, who is in The Godfather and also plays Gazzo from the Rocky series.
Okay, okay.
And also Paddington 2 is an external recurring character.
I was going to say Paddington 2.
Paddington 2 recurring. That's good. Yeah.
Have you done Paddington 2 on this podcast?
We have.
See, I was going to ask before we started awards. So... screw Nicolas Cage, it's Paddington 2.
Yeah, no, that's pretty good. I couldn't follow it. I never saw Paddington 1.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Paddington 2 is so good.
Okay, this one's harder. Roy, best internal recurring character. What do these three movies have in common?
Well, two of them anyway. Did you find it, John? I assume you did.
Oh, no, I didn't look. I assumed it wouldn't. I didn't bother looking.
You
on
thought
the
it would be
search.
Impossible that there would be a crossover between Triple R and The Unbearable Weight, but Tibor Milos Crisco does stunts for both films.
Wow. Oh, dang it. The stunt community, it's so
It's always the stunt community, yep.
I should have realized that. Okay, Brooke, do you have an internal recurring character?
Yes.
You could do Nicolas Cage again.
No, well, I chose the male mafia/military villain.
Mm. Very good.
Yeah.
Because you've got the guy, you've got Lucas.
Yeah.
And you've got Captain British Buttface. And you've got the Godfather.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep, no, that all counts. It counts more than mine. I have garrotes, which is just, you know, strings around suckers' necks, killing them.
So much garroting in The Godfather.
Yeah. So much of it, yeah. And quite a bit in R, too.
Yeah.
Okay, Brookie, best death?
Best death, I went with Sonny.
Yeah. Yep.
Being it's shot. It was, but an honorable mention to Raj's dad and the grenade.
That's a good death.
Oh.
That's how I want to go.
Load? Yeah.
Yeah. Roy?
Okay. I went with Mo Green, who got it right in the glasses.
Oh, yeah. He got it in the glasses. There was someone, I just remembered, there was someone who got it right in the megaphone in her. That was pretty great.
So Mo Green, though, like his last moment on Earth was a massage. So you know what?
That's
there's worse
good.
Way to go. Worse ways yeah. to go. Yeah,
that's a good death. Okay. Honorable mention. Okay. No, actually, Sonny's the answer. But I will honorably mention the there's one British guy who was garroted off his bicycle, I think, and then pulled down to the ground and snapping his neck down on the ground. That was pretty sweet.
Yeah.
But I'm just going to use this opportunity to talk about just the resilience of the British Empire at this point in time, because they're constantly talking. All the British people are talking about how much better they are than these crappy Indians, and how good they are at oppressing the Indians. And they are pretty good. Like they kind of like they hit that girl in the head at the beginning, and they kidnap that other girl. And, you know, I think they may have, like, killed just a couple other people. But they maintain their arrogance when waves after waves of British people are just getting mowed down.
By zoo
by
animals.
By these Indian superheroes. Yeah. It's like India – like Britain 3, India 700, and they're still feeling pretty confident about things. So good job, British Empire. Okay. Brooke, do you have a best villain?
My best villain is I'm an asshole, I'm sorry. Cis men's egos.
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine. I feel personally attacked, but that's fine. Yeah.
Not you. You guys have beautiful egos.
Oh, thank
let me
you.
Say let me say the false ego.
Hmm.
Okay,
because no. We all have an ego, and it's beautiful, but the false ego is really driving these guys into horrible places.
Yeah, okay, I could totally I totally get that, yeah. Okay, Roy, who do you have as villain? I think I know what it is.
Oh, really? My honorable mention is Carlo.
Oh, Carlo's a great villain.
He's pretty bad, but I'm going with the British. Maybe, and if I'm going to be specific, can we say Mrs. Buxton?
That's
yeah.
who I have.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's hardly any blood. There's hardly any blood.
There's
Come
not
on,
enough
let's
blood.
Have more blood. Here, take my personal whip that I'm carrying with me.
Of course you men pick the only woman to villainize.
That's oh, yeah.
Excellent.
I'm kidding.
That's
I'm
excellent
kidding.
Point. No, my real villain is actually drugs.
Oh, good. Good villain.
Okay, Roy, who's your hero?
Oh, it's Beam. Beam is my hero.
Beam is the hero.
Yeah.
Okay. Brooke?
Well, I was too much in psychobabble, but I put love.
Oh my gosh, you and your
psychobabble. That's good. That's good. Okay, my hero is New York City newspapers of the 40s. Because as you remember, Michael and Kay are on a date, in the theater just watching a movie. They leave the movie and they pass a newsstand and there's a newspaper that says Vito Corleone gunned down. Like, they got that newspaper out during the movie, apparently.
They are heroes.
Yeah. So, yeah, just like that's really fulfilling a deadline. Mm. Okay, Brooke, best goof, movie goof.
I didn't know on this one.
Oh, I got a lot of them.
Oh, I only
share. Will you share one for me?
Okay, Brooke, this is yours. Okay. I'm going to do in RRR, what's the good-looking guy's name?
Raju?
His facial hair, like, exits his face and sucks into his face at random times during the movie. When he's a normal guy, he has like a short mustache and a full beard, which was the day after he had the big giant full mustache. And then immediately when he goes back into the service, his full mustache just bursts out of him.
Okay,
so that's yours.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Roy, what's your goof?
Sure. Nick gives Javi his right shoe twice.
Oh, that's a good one. Mm-hmm. Interesting goof. Okay, here's my series of goofs. First of all, goof on Netflix for having Portuguese as the default language for
thank you
for RRR. And then also when Mo Green in The Godfather, his line "I talked to Barzini," it's inexplicably dubbed by James Earl Jones just randomly.
Seriously?
Yeah. Yeah.
What?
Yeah, I'm going to have to send you my version of it. It's insane. It's really strange.
Okay, but
my winner is in the movie Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent. There are constantly Nicolas Cage references, like movies, references to Nicolas Cage movies, like Face Off. It starts with Face Off, and you talk about, you know, and they talk about Mandy and stuff like that.
And but Tess, Guarding Tess.
And Guarding Tess, all these great Nicolas Cage movies, but inexplicably, they never mention Raising Arizona.
I know.
Like, by far the best Nicolas Cage
movie. By far the best Nicolas Cage movie.
Yeah.
I think they did that on purpose.
They didn't want to compare them.
They didn't want to tarnish it.
Yeah. Yeah. That might be true.
With something
that's
good.
That's a good point. That's a good point. Okay, Roy, best LOL moment.
It's got to be Pedro Pascal on acid. Through the whole like stoned paranoid scene. And if I'm going to pick like a moment, it's probably when Nick Cage says, "Now look at those guys, but when you look at them, laugh so that it won't be suspicious." And he just stares at those two old guys and he's just laughing. And it, oh man, that was so funny.
That's pretty good. Yeah. That's pretty good.
That movie really made me laugh so hard.
Okay. All right, Brooke, what's a scene that you laughed harder at?
That was, I mean, the wall moment made me laugh really. He keeps dropping it.
Oh, yeah.
Go without me.
I'm just going to butt in really quick. That was mine.
That was yours?
Javi falling 2 feet from the wall.
Yeah.
Multiple times, yeah.
Yeah.
But I think I laughed even harder at the window scene. When
I can't feel my
another
legs.
Time that Nicholas is on drugs.
I don't remember the scene.
Don't you when he accidentally drugs his own face with the handprint?
He drugs his own face.
And he's like climbing along the ledge and he can't feel his legs.
He drugs himself on and then he goes out on the window. Yeah. Okay.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Well, we're going to help you get that pretty laughter funny. Under control here with the next award, Brooke.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, while you're recovering, the minor, the saddest of all scenes. Roy, why don't you go?
It's probably the flogging.
Yeah, that's
watching funny. Best friend flogging best friend.
That's pretty good. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then they're friends, and then they hug later. They high five later. Okay, Brooke, what was the saddest part?
The saddest part to me was honorable mention to Molly's mom watching her daughter be taken away and then being hit with a tree.
Oh, geez.
Yeah. That one was really sad. But the saddest moment for me was when Beam realized as they listen to Raju's story, well, his fiance tell his story, that they had left him there and that Raj had chosen to let him go. Like that realization of what the real love was for him and what he had given up and what he had done. That part was the saddest moment to me.
Yeah, I think, was that the same scene? I actually picked, as my honorable mention, it's Sita, like, it's after she helps everybody. She feeds everybody, and then she shushes the police away. Yeah, and then she says, you know, it's, my fiance, you know, Raj, he used to say it's great to be nice to people or something like that. She says something, I'm like, oh, of course it's great to be nice to people. But anyway, he's going to be executed. So I just thought it was really sad that she does all those good things, even though she just barely got news that, you know, the person she cares about is going to be executed, which I think is like a lovely moment and a very sad moment too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
But actually my winner is Fredo fumbling the gun when Vito is attacked.
Okay. Oh,
like,
yeah.
Fredo can't do anything with the gun. Mm. Brooke, one of these days you're going to watch Godfather Part 2, and Fredo is a bigger part of that. And so, you know, you always kind of, like, think of Fredo, like, knowing Fredo in Godfather Part 2 as well. So that's kind of why he was on my mind. Okay, best what-the-heck moment. Roy, why don't you start with this one? Because it could go anywhere.
Well, Tree to the Head was a bit of a shocker. But and even though I'd seen this before, I think if you had never seen this movie before, this is probably a pretty shocking moment. The death of Luca Brasi, when they
pin his hand
to the bar with the knife.
I wanted to talk about it because it's so absurd because, Luca Brasi, this is like 30 minutes into the movie, right? Yeah. But all we know about Luca Brasi is, like, the Godfather himself is, like, almost scared of him and intimidated by him. And Michael says, you know, Luca Brasi, you know, he's the only one we trust and he's the one who threatened this guy. Luca Brasi is, like, this huge – like, everyone's afraid of Luca Brasi. And we never see Luca Brasi do any of that because he gets killed right when he does that assignment, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, what the heck, Brooke?
That Luca Brasi one is a good one that I genuinely was like, what?
Yeah.
And then when they shot The Godfather, but I feel like had I not been ruined by Tom Hanks, the horse head would have been.
Yeah, yeah.
But because I had been ruined, it was the moment when the crazy white woman threw the whip down and made them pull it against the tree. Knowing that was about to happen to hit, like, that moment, I almost vomited. It was a lot.
How crazy villainous do you have to be to just carry a whip around wherever you go just in case?
Just in case someone has a whip that's not bad enough.
Yeah.
It's not spiky enough.
It's like, that's not a whip. It is a whip. Okay, honorable mention to RRR being as crazy as it is, and it has the big dance sequence at the end, but once it finally gets to the end credits that are scrolling, just silence. It's like our senses have been used up. But my winner, and I guess I was disproved earlier in this podcast, but I'm like, Jenny, the English woman, likes Beam over Raji, which is like, first of all, this guy knows English, but second of all, and more importantly, he is objectively way hotter.
He's objectively way hotter.
Way hotter than Beam. Oh my gosh. Way hotter. But, you know, I guess.
Sorry for just proving you. I will say I'm much more selective about the women I date.
Okay.
Than the men I date, so maybe he just held a soft spot for me.
Right. Because you would date Raj or Beam, right? I mean,
yes, absolutely.
Right.
If you're listening, I don't care if you speak English.
How is he going to know what you said just now?
Someone will translate and say.
All right. Fine.
There's this crazy white woman in America that wants to date you.
The fourth most important movie podcast in America.
Please don't.
Okay, now overall, Brooke, what's the best scene?
I put the best scene as the flogging scene. leading into the dance. I felt like it was one of the most impactful and moving and showed human spirit and also human horribleness. Like
human blood.
That whole scene, is great.
Yeah. Okay, Roy, best scene.
Honorable mention to the underwater sprint towards each other.
Yeah, pretty good.
But the best scene has got to be the fight at the palace with the zoo animals.
Zoo animals is a good one.
Yeah.
Okay, two honorable mentions from... First of all, of course, the dance-off scene. Like, I was up on one foot just dancing, like, trying to keep up. I'm like, I was, like, in the living room going, playing the music really loud. It just kept building and building and building. But, I mean, you can't dismiss the child saving in the river under the bridge.
Oh, man.
The wordless rope save where they just... clasp arms. It's pretty much, it's like that meme of Arnold Schwarzenegger and Carl Weathers clasping their arms like in Predator, but it's like extended out for 5 minutes. It's perfect. but no, I think the scene is the turlet gun scene in Godfather where Michael has to go get the gun from behind the toilet, but it's not that scene. Like, that's tense enough. It's building up to that, them saying, okay, this is exactly what's going to happen. This is going to happen. This is going to happen. This is going to happen. And then playing it all out too. I always find that like a very riveting scene. Mm. Okay. Best actor, Brooke.
Best actor. I mean, honorable mention to Nicolas Cage playing Nicolas Cage, if that isn't actually Nicolas Cage. So like, well done. But I actually put, what's his name? I was just on it. Hold on. Ram Charan. Raj.
Raj, Ram Charan. Okay. He's good.
For being able to go between, like, hold that stuff in and...
Not only is he devastatingly much better looking than everybody else in all these movies, but he's a great actor.
I have lied to you.
Oh, really?
I have lied to you all.
What?
The picture that I was thinking about was actually Ram Charan. It wasn't Beam.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, so we're
okay, we're all in agreement here. Okay.
So you guys went, I mean, I was looking at pictures of
Beam looks like
Rama Rao just now.
Yeah, Beam is a muscular Belushi.
No, he's still very handsome. Very handsome.
Hmm.
So much so that I was able to, but this one particular picture I was thinking of is actually Ram Charan. Mm. So
okay.
You guys win. Yes.
Yes. Yes.
And he speaks English, so fine.
Yes, he does. Yeah. He does.
You win.
Yeah. Okay, do you hear that?
You know men better than me. Well done.
Come over and date all of us. Okay. Roy, actor.
I'm going with Pedro Pascal. I thought he was incredible.
He's great.
Yeah,
he's
so great.
So good.
Like, he went from The Mandalorian to
this. I know.
Okay.
Is he in The Mandalorian?
Yeah, he is The Mandalorian.
Oh, see, I haven't watched it, clearly.
Well, I mean, you kind of don't know that. I mean, he's got that helmet
you
on
don't
the whole
see his
time,
face
but he's really good.
Until the
he's
end,
really good. Yeah.
I keep falling asleep when I try to watch it, and so I eventually gave up.
Yeah, I'm...
I'll try again now.
I'm drowning in Star Wars right now. I don't know if I didn't finish Obi-Wan. I didn't finish Boba Fett.
Obi-Wan was good.
Obi-Wan was good.
Yeah.
Boba Fett was okay.
Okay. For my actor, I should have put her as guest, actually, but my honorable mention for actor is Sofia Coppola, the director Sofia Coppola.
Yeah.
She plays the baby at the end.
Oh, look
bathroom.
At that.
Yeah.
Well babied.
Yeah, nice baby. But I am going to go with... let's see. His name is he's uncredited, but his name is Gabriele Torre, and he plays Enzo the Baker in The Godfather, and he's the guy who brings flowers to Vito's hospital bed, and Michael says, "Okay, we need you to look intimidating. Pretend you have a gun, all right?" And he's like, "Oh, okay." Anyway, good job acting.
Yeah,
Enzo the Baker.
Well done, sir.
Okay, let's get to those later. You know what? Let's do it right now. Does anybody have any questions on any of these movies?
I don't.
You don't have any questions? Mm-hmm. Brooke, any questions?
I guess my only question is Nick Cage actually Nick Cage, or is he not actually being Nick Cage?
So I want to believe that Nick Cage thinks he was portraying a silly version of himself, but that actually definitely is 100% him.
I think he can't acknowledge it. I think he's trying to play a silly version of himself, but he's more like that than he thinks.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. That's exactly what I'm saying. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. So yes. I hate to agree with you, but yeah, fine. You're right. Okay. My question is, okay, Sollozzo, they're battling Sollozzo, this other crime family, Sollozzo, this whole time. But then at the end, the Godfather, like before he dies, Vito says, oh, it turns out it's Barzini, not Sollozzo, who's pulling all the strings. So, but I don't know how he knows that.
It has something to do with like who approached them at the to make funeral. A deal, right? He's like, whoever approaches you to make a deal, that's who
is going to be the one.
Did this, right? Now, Sollozzo's not a member of one of these. He's not head of one of these crime families. He's kind of like this independent guy who's coming in and pitching drugs to these crime families, right?
I thought he was one of the crime family guys. Like, this family is doing
I thought he was independent also.
I thought he was independent.
So like, Sollozzo's independent, but Barzini is kind of...
Barzini's one of the five New York
one of the five guys who is manipulating things, who's kind of causing trouble, but they don't know. Okay, because they said it's the first person who approaches, but I thought that was whoever approaches first saying Barzini wants to make a deal is the traitor within ourselves, and that was Abe Vigoda, who was I can't remember.
Yeah.
Okay, you know what? I'll watch it again.
Yeah. Go.
I think they're just really in touch with their feminine intuition and empathicness, and that's how we know.
Nice.
They're very feminine.
Okay. Well, they gotta be. No other girls are around. Mm. Let's go. Let's see. Titular okay, line? Next up, titular line. Okay, Roy, do you have a titular line?
Sure. The quote is, yeah, let's talk business, Mike. First of all, you're all done. The Corleone family don't even have that kind of muscle anymore. The Godfather is sick, right? So that's Mo Green.
The Godfather is sick, right? Mo Green is saying that. Yeah. Okay, Brooke, do you have a titular line?
For me, it was as they close the door with Kay looking in and they call him the Godfather.
Ah, very good. Very good. That
simple, scene, but just yeah. That moment. Yeah.
I did want to mention this. I don't think I mentioned this, but I thought it was great. Not only did they close the door on Kay, but right before then, that's when Kay asks him straight up, did you have anything to do with Carlo's death? And he says, honestly, no. And then she believes him, yeah. Which kind of goes back to like, okay, she – and Brooke, I think you were saying that she makes the decision to kind of – to play like almost play the role of believing him, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, my titular line is also in The Godfather, and that is when Michael is talking to Carlo, and he says, don't be afraid, Carlo. Come on, you think I'll make my sister a widow? I'm Godfather to your son. Hmm. And that was right before he had him killed. Okay.
Oh, that's really powerful when you think of it that way.
Yeah.
You're smart.
I try.
That was really impactful.
Brooke, do you have a favorite quote from these movies?
My favorite quote is the one that I said earlier. They get when Nick Cage tells his daughter she can pick the movie, and she says, have you seen Paddington 2?
Oh, that's good. Raymond,
sure. Quote. Honorable mention to Beam, how long do we fight these jackals? Let us hunt down the lion. My favorite quote is actually from The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent. And the quote is, you tell him Nick Cage smooches good.
Nick Cage smooches good. That's pretty good. That didn't happen in adaptation.
Nope.
Okay, my favorite quote, and this is an offensive quote. It makes me laugh, even though it's a bad quote, but I think it's kind of funny. It's when Tom Hagen goes and visits the Hollywood producer, and the Hollywood producer is just a terrible human being, and he goes, listen, it doesn't matter how many of you Italian greaseballs mess me up or whatever he says. And then Tom Hagen says, I'm German-Irish. And then the Hollywood producer says immediately, listen, my Kraut Mick friend.
Oh, man.
That's great. Okay. All right, time for taglines. Roy, do you want to go through your favorite tagline and your new tagline?
There's only one if you're going off the posters. It's Nicolas Cage. Right. Nick Cage.
I thought for sure, Roy, you would pick 25th March, whatever.
So,
right?
No, I saw that. I'm like, hey, my birthday.
Yeah.
So my alternates, though, for The Godfather, I've got leave the gun, take the cannoli. For Triple R, my tagline would just be in all caps and about 20 exclamation marks, just the word, yeah! And then for The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, I'd put, it's shamanic acting.
Oh, that's so, pretty good.
Yeah.
Okay, Brooke, your favorite tagline and new taglines.
Can we do yours first?
Yes, we can.
I like my to be favorite, influenced.
My favorite tagline is Nicolas Cage is Nick Cage. Yeah, of course. Okay, my Godfather tagline is, they may be Catholics, but in this family, their father is God.
Ooh.
And my Triple R, okay, I have three of them. And one of them is, it's bro at first sight. And then the other one is MMA dance off. And then the other one in a Charles DeMar voice, he's dancing on one leg. Yeah. Okay.
Oh man. Okay.
I didn't think that would be the one you liked. I thought so. Okay. I didn't think. Okay. Unbearable weight of massive talent. My tagline is from the mind of Donald Kaufman. .. Uh-huh. Now, Donald Kaufman, of course, is the alter Charlie's ego of brother. Nicolas Cage in adaptation, who does the Hollywood.
Well played. Well played. All right. Well, my favorite is obviously Nicolas Cage's Nick Cage.
Yes.
My alternate taglines for The Godfather is, what happens when instead of resolving family trauma, you honor it?
Ooh.
My alternate tagline for RRR is RRR, are you going to do something about this? that's much funnier to me. You guys, you know Billy Madison, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Are you going to the mall later? No, Billy, spell couch. So anyways, that clearly didn't come off lost in translation. And Nick Cage is Nick Cage in The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, otherwise known as Daddy Issues That Daddy Won't Acknowledge.
Oh, good.
Okay, all sorry. Right. Not them. They clearly weren't even the look.
they're great. No. I'm low energy right now. My AC went off. I have to conserve all my breath. Yeah. Okay. Let's do a few. I don't know if we discussed special awards, but really quick, I maybe go through a couple of these pretty quick. But I want to talk about what the masculinist movie is.
Oh.
I'm saying The Godfather because yeah, there were two women in it.
Yeah, it's The Godfather.
Yeah.
They had to do that. Okay. Now, who was the brookest character?
Ooh. Who are you asking first?
I'll ask myself first. Okay. I went with Addie Cage, Nicolas Cage's daughter.
Oh.
Well, good call.
I went with Beam.
Right.
Aww.
He's great. He protects the village really well.
He throws tigers great like with, no one's.
He's
business.
Great with tigers, yeah. Brooke, who would you say is your favorite character? Or your Brooke is
the
not your favorite
character.
Character. Your Brookest character, yeah.
I really like Beam, and I wish I could claim Beam. I would go with either Kay or...
Mrs. Buxton.
No! Nicolas Cage's ex-wife.
Mm.
Oh, okay. Sharon Horgan. She's pretty
yeah.
good. Okay, and Roy, what would you say is the brookiest scene?
I'm going to go with The Godfather wedding, not because weddings define Brooke, but
no.
because I've had so many of them.
It's such a joyous occasion. That wedding just seems
yes.
like it's such a good time, and it's all about family.
I picked the same scene, mostly because of it's a great introduction to all the characters,
yeah.
and I think that works well. Brooke, do you have a brookiest scene?
I would say the zoo animal fight.
Yes.
that's true. That matches up pretty good.
All right, very good.
You're not allowed to answer this one. So
right, the Brookest movie.
Yeah. John, what's your guess?
I didn't write this down, but I'm going to put Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent.
As am I.
Based on her reaction to the movie. Yeah. So I, you know, that's the only reason, but not anything that's actually in the movie.
Hmm.
So yeah, don't answer. Oh, here's one for you to answer, Brooke. Since these movies are all new to you and you didn't know what to expect, what is your newest movie, or what was the most unexpected movie? It's probably the same answer, maybe.
The most unexpected?
Yeah.
That I like, or just that I didn't expect it?
Just that you didn't expect, you know. Oh, okay.
Yeah, very good.
Yeah. It's me too, I think. I think, you know, I'd heard it's like, you got to watch this movie, it's crazy. And I'm like, I'll see how crazy. And then I'm like, it's crazy.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. All right, let's hurry and rank these suckers. We're already over time, which I apologize. Roy, let's start with you. Number three, please.
So, again, the same caveat I always give. I enjoyed all of these. My number three is The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent.
Okay. Wait, how do we do this? Oh, wait, we're supposed to start with Brooke, weren't we? Okay,
were.
Brooke, why don't you go? Why don't you go next, Brooke?
Okay. It's hard for me. I don't want to admit it.
It's okay. We're here for you.
Yeah, we'll be here.
Be strong.
As far as, like, enjoyment of the movie... Like, just sheer...
Whatever criteria you want to use.
Enjoyment. I'd say The Godfather.
Number three.
Oh!
Okay.
John, I knew it.
John, no, what's your fine. Number three, then?
But as far as, like, most impactful, I would say Massive Talent.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. No, so does that totally mean fine. That Triple R is your number two?
wait. No,
so
no.
Is The Godfather your third favorite of these three as we're trying
it
to
is.
Rank these? It is, right?
It
number
is,
three,
right.
The Godfather?
Yeah. It's number three. Number three is The Godfather, right? Yeah.
I don't know.
That's
I can't
fine.
Decide. Oh,
okay. Ma'am, life's about tough choices.
Sense. Yeah. Oh, no, that's fine. Okay. Let's see. I'll say... Okay, my number... Oh, I didn't say my number three.
No.
My number three is... And let me just put the caveat that I liked most of these movies. I just want to put that out. My number three is Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent.
Mm.
Okay, let's flip around to Roy first. Roy, what's your number two?
Okay. So, by any objective criteria, and by probably a decent margin, the best movie here is The Godfather. But on this night and on this podcast, my number two is The Godfather.
Oh, wow. Okay. Wow. Perfect.
I'm going with The Godfather's number two also.
So, what was your number three?
Yeah.
Massive Talent.
Okay.
Is
so, okay, so
no,
Talent
no,
is...
just kidding. Godfather is number three. Massive Talent is number two.
Okay.
Massive Talent is number two.
So
wow.
Okay, so actually, Brooke
so
and I both have the same
it's the hardest
one.
You've laughed in like decades. That means
I know
that RRR is your number one. So what?
It is.
So it did. It didn't make you laugh the most in decades. But what emotion did it elicit to have it somersault right over Massive Talent for you?
Love.
Oh. So,
oh.
So and
the purpose
so,
and core of life.
Yeah. So what I felt about RRR is so John, you want to give us your number two?
My number two is RRR.
Okay, so you ended with The Godfather, which is the
yeah.
Also Unmassive Talent. Oh.
So here's how I feel about Triple R though, right? And this is kind of like the TV test, like if these movies were on TV, which one am I going to watch? Sort of that way. Mm-hmm. But also like for the last week, every single day, I've thought to myself, at least at one point, I want to watch Triple R right now.
Really?
Right? Like, yeah. I'm dying to watch it again. Like, that, I thought it was just incredible and incredibly enjoyable. And it was so close to being ridiculously bad, but it was never ridiculously bad. It was always ridiculously awesome.
Good looking?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Really, really ridiculously good looking. Yeah. Again, and it's like a fine line. Whatever they did to make me love it and not scoff at it.
Yeah.
And I don't know what that imperceptible thing is, what that like indefinable thing is, but it's just like, that's the whole movie. It's just like, you want to be here. You want to be watching this movie. It's like the ultimate spectacle. Yeah. So,
the Facebook fans voted Godfather, number one, by a wide margin. And then there was a tie for Triple R and Unbearable Weight. which you contributed to a vote on the unbearable weight.
Did I?
Yeah, you did.
I'm unreliable.
All right.
Okay. Yeah, these are going to be really hard records to keep. You know,
I think I was feeling bad for it.
Yeah, you got our bookkeeper working overtime and like in your official rankings here. Okay, that's it. We're done.
Never being
done
asked back.
Proper.
Yeah.
No. You are asked back. You have to come.
Oh, right. I have to.
Yeah, you might. I'm sorry.
You have no choice. You're locked in. The contract is out. Don't make us, you know,
chase you down.
Do the horse head thing. Yeah. Okay, so next time, as far as future business goes, Roy, why don't you tell us what's going on? Because I can't remember what one.
Sure. Okay, fans have, from Neighbors from Hell, that's what we're watching with Brooke.
That's
in 2 weeks.
We're watching.
And the fans, by 3 votes, have picked The Burbs, which is an excellent choice. If you want to know what else was popular, 6 votes was Rosemary's Baby. And 5 votes to Manhattan Murder Mystery. And then there was just a
Manhattan
scenario.
Murder Mystery would have been so great.
Maybe.
Would have been great.
Now,
I know
Brooke,
you'd rather watch that.
Brooke, it is up to you to now choose a Neighbors from Hell movie to watch.
Don't I get to hear yours first?
Nope, ma'am. I'm third pick.
All right. I'm going with Tin Rillington Place.
What?
The movie Tin Rillington Place.
So,
like the number 10?
The number 10.
The number 10.
How do you
Rillington Place.
Okay, wow. I have never heard of this movie in my life. Tin Rillington. It exists 1970s with Richard Attenborough.
Wow. I don't know this movie
yet. I thought it was a pretty safe bet that you hadn't watched it on the podcast yet.
Yeah.
Is this a true story?
Yes.
Okay. Wow. Okay.
It's rated GP. I've never heard of that rating.
I was going to go with Deliverance, but I thought I might get some pushback from you guys. And then I just kept hearing what a horrible waste of space it was to actually watch that movie. And so I went
with
this.
So I would say that I think I would have pushed back. I don't know what the neighbor angle is in Deliverance.
Well, I mean, they're just out and they're neighbors to each other. I don't know. Clearly, I haven't seen it.
Big N
neighbors. Clearly, I haven't seen it. Yeah.
Okay, so this throws me for a little bit of a loop because you picked kind of an older film. And I like having a variety.
Were you going to do Rosemary's Baby?
I was not.
Oh.
Man. So is Burbs
Laura?
Is an 80s movie, right? Is Burbs late 80s?
Yes.
Burbs is 89.
Early. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay. So I feel comfortable with this. I kind of wanted kind of a – so Burbs will fit for the comedy of the three. So I feel comfortable sticking with my choice of Rear Window.
Oh.
Ooh,
oh.
Good.
Remember what I told you at our live event, Roy. Rear Window, I was saving it for our next live event when we do bad neighbor Halloween movies. Okay.
Well, here we are. But I like Rear Window because we can have a discussion on who the bad neighbor is. And have you seen it, Brooke?
I have not.
Oh, well, okay.
Wow. Okay.
I was about to spoil the whole thing for you. But
you got to watch Rear Window.
Yeah, so that makes me happy. So otherwise, I probably would have gone with Neighbors with Dan Aykroyd, which I've never seen. But I'm also afraid since I've never seen it, maybe it's an awful film. I don't know.
It's supposed to be legendarily awful, which is why I was pushing for it so hard. I'm like so curious about how bad it could possibly be.
I will tell you, I haven't seen Tin Rillington Place. It was a suggestion that was made in the horror movie club that I'm in at work.
Okay.
Horror movie book club. And it came with such strong recommendation that – and it seemed interesting enough that I –
No, I'm excited.
Hopefully it's good.
Yeah. I don't know about Rotten Tomatoes. I'm sure it's pretty high there. But on IMDb, it's 7.5, which is like not the highest it could be, but like really good. Like 7.5. It's like, yeah, that's very dependable.
For a 70s movie, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so all right. Now, the other polls that we had going on were for the Horror Fest that's coming up. So we got to get this all sorted out real quick. Me, John, and Zoe, and we each have a week. So the first week is going to be me, and the vote was between horror comedies and non-Dracula vampire movies. And checking, and I'm correct, non-Dracula vampire movies has won. So that is what we will watch in week one of Halloween Fest. Week two of Halloween Fest is John, and once again losing his horror or scary documentaries, although for a while there it was doing pretty good.
Dang it. Okay.
And so we will watch Girl Monsters / Antagonist, which I'm very excited about. I don't know what movie I'm going to pick because there's like five I'm super excited for.
Really?
And so we'll see. And then, of course, week last of our Halloween Fest, by a landslide, we will be watching Stephen King movies.
Okay, great. It really bugs me that we're not watching Room 237 followed by The Shining.
I know. It would have been a good match.
Yeah. That would have been great.
Well, what can you do? So what we'll do is in 2 weeks on our next podcast, we'll have Zoe come on and we will reveal our three vampire movies that do not include Dracula. And that will start us off.
Okay.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, before then, for one more week, for one more time, we get Brooke with Bad Neighbor movies.
Which these
kind of starting off,
Yeah, it's like a soft entry into Halloween, right?
Yeah.
The gateway drug.
Yeah, Burbs, and then a movie about a serial killer, and then Rear Window. I think that it's
these could all be Halloween movies.
Yeah.
That's great. That's a great entrance. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Brooke, for that great pick, but mostly thank you for putting up with us for several hours.
Sorry.
Right before your vacation time. The timing, it worked out well for us. I hope that you drive safely.
Thank you.
Please drive safely.
Because you're totally out of here. That's it for the podcast. So we can totally stop recording. Right. Do you guys have anything else?
I don't.
You guys are lovely. Thank you for a wonderful deep dive into bro movies that I enjoyed way more than I would have ever.
We're glad we can guide you. If there's one thing we're good at, it's being men.
No, that's okay.
Yeah.
I always knew that even since high school.
Thanks so much.
Beautiful.
You're
okay.
So much fun.
You're so much fun, bro. Okay, with that, goodbye, everybody. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
John, you're in charge.
I am in charge. Okay, is everybody ready?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Okay, do you have your greetings?
Oh, shoot, no, I forgot.
Okay, let's see. Roy, what was one of the ones you didn't use?
Oh, I only came up with one because it's a real winner. But let's see, what's a good one?
What does the greeting need to be around?
Okay.
The movies, right?
Here you go. You could say, this is Brooke, and then you can affect your awful Italian accent. You could say, I hope, John, that your first child is a masculine child, and then you're done. So.
Okay.
Is John correct?
No, no, I'm good. You guys go.
You got something?
Okay, so it's not what Roy just said?
No, it's not what Roy just said.
Okay, is everybody ready?
Yeah.
Okay, hey, everybody. Welcome to Yours, Mine, and Theirs.